neighbors. This is Long John with the Party Line. We're around from midnight to 5:30, 6 mornings during the week. Monday mornings, we get started about 1. We continue through to 5:30, and that means we're around for 37 and a half hours a week. During the past week or last week, I mentioned quite often that we would have what I consider to be a very, very exciting discussion this morning. Or maybe you think we're still in Monday. Actually, we're into Tuesday morning already. First, let me bring you up to date. Major Donald E. Kehoe, United States Marine Corps flyer retired and author of 3 books on UFOs, commonly called flying saucers, and presently director of National Investigations Committee on Aerial Phenomena of Washington, D.C., was a guest on the Armstrong Circle Theater Wednesday night, the 22nd of January, 1958. If you've been listening to the Party Line, you certainly remember that we discussed that particular telecast. We spent a lot of time on it. Now, the show was scripted, and all guests and professional performers appearing thereon are supposed to undergo 2 days of rehearsal and then read their lines from teleprompters. On the program with Major Kehoe were first its senior writer, who sat in as a guest for Mr. Kenneth Arnold, because Arnold refused to appear after the last rehearsal. Now, Major Kehoe was allotted about 5 minutes immediately after the Air Force representative read from his teleprompter several statements that would confirm the existence of UFOs. Well, now, wait a moment. At this point, some people may be a little confused. You may be under the impression that I have made the statement that the Air Force representative led people to believe that there is an existence of UFOs. Actually, it was Major Kehoe's opinion. In fact, I think that he implied that these UFOs are coming from outside this Earth. Now, Major Kehoe concluded his allotted time for the final 20 seconds with an ad-lib statement that was not in the script. Now, this statement was monitored from the air by at least 2 private citizens and recorded by them on tape. Unfortunately, it was inaudible to the average listener due to the volume having been cut down almost to the minimum at some physical point between the microphone being used by Major Kehoe and the TV transmitter then being used. Now, this could have been at any one of several points. However, this is what I consider to be very important. Kehoe's statement, which faded at the 13th word, was finally cut off. Now, this is quite different technically from a fade. Actually, it was cut off 2 words before the end. Now, I have been told, and I hope I'm not wrong, but to bring you up to date, this is supposed to be part of the statement that you heard and part of the statement that you didn't hear, which you may be hearing for the first time this morning. Kehoe made this statement: "I would like to make a disclosure that has never been revealed to the public." Now, at this point, fade began. In other words, the microphone seemed like, just like at home, if somebody got up to your volume control and turned it down slowly. Now, according to 2 private citizens, possibly many more, but 2 of them that knew enough how to record this, even at that low volume, told me that this was the balance of the statement. I will read it for you. "For the last 6 months, our committee has been working with a Senate committee which is investigating UFOs. If the hearings are held in open hearing, I feel it will prove beyond doubt that the flying saucers are real. In order to secure the information we need, we suggest that all of the citizens write to, and at this point, there was a true cut. There was absolutely no sound. Now, according to a lip reader that contacted me, I've been told that the last two words were, "Your congressman." Now, no sooner had the video cut to Douglas Edwards, who was the MC of the show, when the telephones began to ring. Now, actually, a large number of viewers wanted to know what Kehoe had said, and they also wanted to know what had happened. Many of them, naturally, were crying censorship. And within hours, a series of statements were issued to the wire services. Most of them attributed to CBS spokesmen. And also a phone report was made by Irving Tunick, the writer of the show who sat in for Kenneth Arnold. And of course, actually, I'm the one that received that report. Now, I've got a lot of things to sort of straighten out with you first so that you'll know exactly what took place on that telecast. And of course, we'll hear statements from Major Kehoe and from many of the other people, but before we get into that part of the discussion, let me take just a moment to talk about one of our sponsors, BP. And you know, you don't have to worry about a college degree. This is now in just 16 weeks. There's no long lectures because you learn by doing, just jockey. Please keep that in mind. Now, before we get back with our discussion, and I might add that we'll be hearing from Cortland Hastings, Jules B. St. Germain, Major Kehoe. In case you're not aware of this, Major Kehoe is director of NICAP. That's National Investigations Committee on Aerial Phenomena. And they're located at 1536 Connecticut Avenue, Washington 6, D.C. This is a nonprofit organization. Now, before we get back into the discussion, and I would suggest to you to call your friends and neighbors and tell them to join us tonight in 710. At 710 in your dial. This is WOR Radio, your station in New York. It's important to have them with us because this is a very, very important discussion this morning. Now, let me take just a moment to talk about the beautiful Golden Thread Cafe in the... Believe me, that was a very, very exciting night because I know according to the letters and telegrams that I received, people were very, very concerned about the fact that Major Kehoe had been cut off. That was Wednesday night, the 22nd of January. Now, we went on with the party line at midnight that night. I don't know if you call it that night or the following morning, but just in a matter of seconds, we were into the morning of January the 23rd. And we discussed that Armstrong Circle Theater telecast. It was sort of a documentary. It was about flying saucers. And I was quite amazed why Mr. Kenneth Arnold did not show up. But however, about 2:15 or 2:30, on the morning of January 23rd, I received a telegram from Irv Tunick. Now, Mr. Tunick was the writer of the Armstrong Circle Theater for that particular telecast. Irv Tunick. Now, let me read the telegram. I have it in front of me now. It's addressed to Long John Neville Radio Station, WOR New York. K, that's a funny thing. K, I wonder what K stands for. Well, it's... Now, as a writer of Armstrong Circle Theater, extremely anxious to give you all the facts on the Kehoe incident. Have been up since 5. Am in need of sleep badly. Would appreciate your call if you really want authentic report. Now, at that time, when I received that telegram, I contacted Mr. Irv Tunick at his home. I might also say, in the telegram, he included his home phone number, which I have deleted because I don't think it should be given out on the air. Now, we recorded that conversation. It was a beeper phone conversation. and so that you can be brought up to date what Mr. Tunick had to say about that particular telecast, we're going to play that back for you right now. Do you have that set up, Tommy? All right, let's hear that telephone conversation that I had with Irv Tunick, the writer of the Armstrong Circle Theater, on the morning of January 23rd.
Hello.
Hello.
Mr. Tunick.
How are you? I'm awful glad you called because I'm awful tired.
Fine. Mr. Tunick, you know we're on the air on a beeper phone.
That's quite all right.
Is that all right, sir?
Certainly.
Fine. And unfortunately, I did not get your number. I had no knowledge of your call until this very moment when the telegram was delivered to me. All right, Mr. Tunick, are you aware of the fact that we've been talking about it tonight?
Oh, yes. I caught it coming home from the studio in my car.
Uh-huh.
And I got home about 12:25.
Mm-hmm.
Called at that time.
Mm-hmm.
And very honestly, I've been up ever since. It's a strain.
Yeah, I can understand. Well, I'm sorry. I did not get that information.
Surely.
Well, what actually happened, Mr. Tunick?
Well, let me give you the details. First of all, let me correct a few things that... evidently, reports coming to you are not quite right.
Mm-hmm.
First of all, to my knowledge, Major Captain Ruppelt is not in town.
To your knowledge, Ruppelt is not in town.
No, the last conversation we had with Captain Ruppelt was that he could not get a leave of absence from his position in California.
Mm-hmm.
And it was for that reason, in the main, that he was not on the program. It was purely on his part. We originally did ask him to come and... We would have liked to have had him.
Oh, well, there is... I hope that I did not imply that you did not invite him.
Mm-hmm.
It was told to me that he was invited and that he was billed. In other
yes,
words, that
correct.
He was programmed, but I have been told, and this I do not know from Ruppelt, but I have been told that he did not want to go on the program the last minute that he sent a wire and canceled.
I have no knowledge of any such wire. In my conversation with Captain Ruppelt, he expressed rather an eagerness to come on the program.
Mm-hmm.
So I know nothing further about any telegrams, if any, did arrive.
Mm-hmm.
And as to his being in town, if he is, it's a surprise to me. The last I know, I spoke to him in California.
Kenneth Arnold is in town, is
yes,
that right,
Mr.
sir?
Mr. Arnold came into town Monday.
I see.
We brought him into town from Boise, Idaho.
Mm-hmm.
We had previously, over a period of a couple of weeks, made arrangements for him and his wife. We brought them both in. We put them up here in New York.
Yes.
He appeared at rehearsal for 2 days.
Mm-hmm.
This morning, we received a telegram that he would not appear. And he did not appear. As a result, I had a pinch hit. You know, I kind of sat in for him.
Mr. Tunick, may I ask you this question?
Sure.
Did he say in his telegram why he didn't want to appear?
Well, very honestly, and I'm being extremely honest, I did not see a copy of the telegram.
Fine.
I understand that he sent a telegram to the producer and to newspapers around town, giving his reasons. I believe he felt that there was not enough time being given to his side of the story.
Uh-huh.
Now, in that regard, we have a signed statement from Major Keogh, in which he states that our program was handled objectively and fairly, and that...
Was this a statement that was signed after the program, sir?
No, it was a statement that was signed much before the program went on the air when we heard that Mr. Arnold would not appear.
Oh, I see. Mm-hmm.
Now, as to the very, what shall we call it, the sad incident that occurred,
mm-hmm.
I work very closely with Major Keogh, and if you call him, incidentally, I don't want to mention where he's staying, but I have that information, and I can get it to you. I'm sure he'll...
No, don't give it on the air.
No,
please.
I won't.
Because we're on the air now. You
yes,
don't.
I won't do it. But he will verify what I'm saying you now. I work with him very hard. He cooperated with me beautifully, and I think I did the script more or less as he wanted it.
Mm-hmm.
When he went on the air, he began to make the statement, as quoted by yourself and Mr. Sanderson, is it?
Yes, Ivan Sanderson.
That's right. He did make that statement. At that time, the director and the producer, working under CBS regulations, had to flip the key and cut the audio. Because we did not know what statement was coming out. The statement had not been approved by a continuity acceptance. As you know, must be done on network shows.
Mm-hmm.
We did not know if the Senate subcommittee he mentioned had approved his statement. And in view of that fact, and as I say, by regulation, they had to cut the speech. And no one felt worse about it than the people attached to the program.
Well, then, naturally, the next question that I would normally ask, I cannot ask because you're not going to give it to me anyway. In other words, you would not be in a position to tell me what he said during the time that the mic was cut off.
No, I would not be in a position. I do know that following the show, INS called, and he did give them the statement. And he also, after the program, again signed another statement.
Yes.
In which he stated that he regretted the incident. He was not aware of these regulations. He had been permitted a certain amount of ad-lib during the course of his presentation, and he did not realize that a statement such as this did not fall into the ad-lib category.
Mr. Tunick, I am a Johnny-come-lately in this business.
No, I am much more lately in the flying saucer business.
I was never familiar with that ruling.
Well,
I mean, we don't have it in radio anyway. Are you saying, then, that if I were to be interviewed by somebody on television, that we would have to have a prepared interview?
No. When you have an interview program, obviously it's an ad-lib program. But when a program is scripted, it must pass through continuity acceptance. Now, you know that as well as I do. And all of the material is placed on teleprompter, you see. Now, obviously, no one expects anyone to follow a teleprompter word by word. There is a certain latitude given. However, and put yourself in this position if you're the producer or the director.
Yes.
The statement comes out, I am now going to say something that has never been revealed before. You don't know what that statement is. You have no idea if it's been cleared by the proper authorities who are being mentioned. It has not been cleared by continuity acceptance. You are at the mercy of the person who is making the statement. And it's a general rule that at that time, the director has no prerogative but to cut the show. Now, this is a fact, and we felt awful about it. This is not a matter of censorship.
Yes.
As it turned out, I believe the statement was fairly innocuous. And possibly might have gone just the way, you know, on the air. But,
In other words, it was not a world-shattering statement.
No, I don't think it was.
Well, you heard the statement. I'm not asking you to repeat it.
I didn't hear the statement. No, I was in the control room.
Oh, you didn't hear it?
No, you see, we cut the audio and we lost it in the control room.
Oh, yes, that's true. I didn't realize that.
Yes. So that, I do know that following the show, the INS called, and he gave them the statement. But it was strictly a matter of routine.
I mean,
it was not a question of any type of censorship. As a writer, I'm very much sensitive the points of censorship. And I can assure you that this does not enter into it one little bit. Nor did the Air Force in any way control our program. The original idea for the program was our own. We set about it just as we set about any other program. We were very pleased when the Air Force offered us cooperation, when they opened their files to us. As a matter of fact, I had the files in my home for a number of days, working on the show.
Mr. Tunick, I had just one more question.
Yes,
in
but
my
before
mind,
your question,
yes,
may I just correct one other statement?
Yes.
Mr. Sanderson said it was cut off for a minute and a half. It was cut off for exactly 18 seconds.
18 seconds.
That's right.
I think, I don't know if Mr. Sanderson made the statement. I know that I made it before. I thought it was approximately a minute and a half, and I apologize. I was not timing it, believe me.
Now, if you would like to get Mr. Kehoe's statement that he signed following the program,
yes.
That statement would be available to you tomorrow if you call Talent Associates, the producers of the show.
What is the...
Talent Associates.
Talent Associates.
Yes. Their address is 41 East 50th.
41 East 50th.
I won't give the phone number because
think we should. No. I can find that out. All right. I was just wondering... why? In other words, I'm certainly not being critical because I'm not a critic. But I was just wondering why on a program that was a documentary program and you had so many different angles of the flying saucers involved, how is it that somebody like Adamski or Van Tassel or, you know, one of the people who have made the the claim that they've had a physical contact with Martians or Venusians. How is it one of those were not put in?
Well, a very good reason, because we were suffering under what might be called a stringency of time.
I see.
After all, Don Keogh does make the point, and I think a valid point, that he did not have equal time with the Air Force.
Mm-hmm.
It was not because of any other reason except time.
Yes.
We had to cut 12 minutes out of the show.
Mm-hmm.
After our first craft.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the only reason, because we have no axe to grind. We were trying to prepare an objective and impartial program.
Mr. Tunick, another question comes to my mind then. If you had planned on having Kenneth Arnold on the program, we know that Repelt, he couldn't get away from his job, but you did bring Mr. and Mrs. Arnold into New York.
Yes, you did.
And they were going to be on the program. Well,
he was going to be on the program.
I mean, he was going to. I'm sorry, sir. He was going to be on the program. What happened to the time that he was going to have on the program?
I pinched in. I sat in for him. Because it was done. You see, we had no notification of this.
I see.
He sent us a telegram, which arrived about 1 o'clock this afternoon.
I'm familiar with the telegram.
That's right. And we were caught.
Mm-hmm.
You know, after all, we're all on teleprompter. Everything is set in the show. We were ready to go into our run-through.
Mm-hmm.
And suddenly, one of our guests just doesn't appear.
Right.
Well, what do? We kind of jerry-rigged it. I sat in for him, and I read the lines.
Right.
As we could. And we felt very badly about it. We do think that, in all fairness, we should have been informed, at least in person, not to be informed by a telegram. I don't think your service was done to anyone in that regard.
Mm-hmm. Well, Mr. Tunick, I have on this beeper phone an 8-second delay.
Go ahead.
And some of my guests here are only hearing our conversation now. They're picking it up. So if you give me just a second or two, I just want to see if any of the others, they have headsets on. That's the way they listen to it. And I just want to find out if there's anything else that possibly Ivan or Charles Liedem or any of the other guests would like to ask.
Sure.
One question that Ivan Sanderson has raised. Why wasn't Arnold's name mentioned by the Air Force?
By the Air Force?
Mm-hmm.
I don't know why his name wasn't mentioned by the Air Force.
The only reason that I think that Ivan brought that question up is the fact that he was former head of the United States Air Force Project Blue Book.
You mean Repelt?
Yes.
Oh, I thought you asked about Kenneth Arnold. I think you asked me if Arnold's name was mentioned. You meant why Repelt's name was
mentioned.
I have to give you the same answer. I just don't know.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it just didn't come up, but I recall at any time that they would mention him. I didn't know why they would.
Mm-hmm.
It certainly was no case deleted.
Yes. You've already answered the question. Ivan is once again writing me a note here, and he was wondering, wait a minute, what's this, Ivan? Well, Ivan, just a moment. Do you want to pick this up a moment and finish this up with him? You want to? Yes, sure. Just a moment, Mr. Tunick.
All right.
We have some difficulties here to get, but Ivan would like to talk to you a moment on the beeper phone to get some additional information.
Sure.
Just a moment, sir.
How do you do, sir?
How do you do, Ivan?
Sir, there's one thing I'm very interested in. I noticed that the gentleman, I think, from the Air Force, he kept on saying he never mentioned Kenneth Arnold's name, but said that he was one of the pilots who was looking for a lost plane round about...
Now, wait, you have that a little wrong. It was in my section that Kenneth Arnold sighting was discussed, not in the Air Force. The Air Force...
Oh, I beg your pardon. I wasn't quite sure which it was.
That's right.
I happened to see it. In other words, because Kenneth Arnold was not there...
That's right. His name was not...
Well, not mentioned, though, I see. But that was the same person you were talking about, the pilot who was looking for the lost plane.
Well,
I
don't want to get into any kind of a legal situation.
I beg your pardon. All right, I know. I'm sorry, I shouldn't have asked that. I just wanted to know if it's the same man, but I understand what you mean. You can't obviously answer that question if you can't answer the other one. Here's John again. Thank you, sir.
All right.
Well, Mr. Tunick, thank you very, very much for
quite all right.
Getting in touch with us.
I thank you for the very kind words you had to say about the program as a whole.
I enjoyed it.
Well, that's very good. We're happy, and we really are very... We're sad that this situation had to come up because we thought it was a good program that the audience would be interested in. And we don't want the audience to feel that they've been cheated in any way.
Fine.
It was an emergency message, you understand that.
Fine. Thank you very much, Mr. Tunick.
Good night,
sir.
Well, that was the telephone conversation, beeper phone conversation, that I had with Irv Tunick on the morning of January 23rd. Actually, that was the morning after the Armstrong Circle Theater telecast, the one that they had in reference to flying saucers with Major Donald E. Keyhoe, and they were supposed to have Kenneth Arnold, but Mr. Arnold did not show. Before I continue along, and believe me, we've got some exciting things for you, of course, we'll be talking with Major Donald E. Keyhoe, Cortland Hastings, Jules B. St. Germain, and we'll get a lot of information. But before we get into that, let me take a moment to talk about... Now, getting back to our discussion of the morning. Kenneth Arnold is the man who really coined the phrase flying saucers. This is back in the year of 1947. And Kenneth Arnold is a very respected person, a man who I might add is considered to be just about tops in his field as not only a private pilot, but also a very keen businessman, and just about everybody in the flying saucer field has great respect for Kenneth Arnold. Now, Mr. Arnold, it had been suggested by Mr. Irv Tunick and Mr. Robert Costello of the Armstrong Circle Theater that he come into New York to participate in this program. And I'd like to add at this time that he was given a check for $250. Just about 3 weeks ago, he sent me that check. It was made out to him. He endorsed it over to the WOR Christmas Fund. He would not accept payment, although it did cost him a considerable amount of money to come in from Boise, Idaho, and he had hotel expenses, and his fee of $250, he turned it over to my favorite charity, which happens to be the WOR Christmas Fund. And I think that that was a large sum, too, $250. So, again, I'd like to just say thanks to Kenneth Arnold for turning that check over to me. Now, the following day, again, January 23rd, I made every effort to get in touch with Kenneth Arnold. I might also say that I tried to get in touch with Major Keyhoe, but that seemed to be impossible. I was told that Major Keyhoe was not talking. I heard a lot of rumors, but actually Major Keyhoe held a press conference, and I did not know about this until, I'd say 10 or 11 o'clock in the morning. That is the morning of January 23rd. However, about 2 o'clock in the afternoon, I was fortunate enough to get in touch with Kenneth Arnold. I might say that I'm very grateful to a lady who made the arrangements for me, and I'm talking about Virginia Belmont. Virginia Belmont owns the Belmont Bird and Kennel Shop in Radio City, and she made the connection for me, giving Mr. Arnold my private phone number. He called me and I said to him that I would like to talk to him on the beeper phone so that our listeners could understand exactly what happened, and he said he was agreeable, and he permitted me to have his private phone number, and I called him on the phone and I had the following conversation. So Tommy, if you will please, Tommy Reynolds, that particular tape, that beeper telephone conversation that I had with Kenneth Arnold in the afternoon of January 23rd, I'd like the listeners to hear it now.
Hello, Mr. Kenneth Arnold?
That's right.
This is Long John from WOR, sir. I'm very happy to have this opportunity of talking with you. I'm
Sorry, though, that you weren't able to join us on the program. But I was wondering, did you hear any of the program that we had on last night in reference to the Armstrong Circle Theater program?
I did, Long John. In fact, I stayed up the entire night to hear the entire program.
Well, believe me, I'm very proud, Mr. Arnold. Actually, we need the listeners, so we've added a couple. Mr. Arnold, I know you're a very busy man, but very frankly, there's a couple of questions I would like to ask. First of all, a Mr. Irving Tunick, who is the writer of that particular program that was on the Armstrong Circle Theater last night, told me during a two-way beeper telephone conversation that the Armstrong people paid for you and Mrs. Arnold to come from Boise, Idaho to New York, and I understand they picked up the tab at the hotel, and that you rehearsed for 2 days, and at the end of that time, in other words, the day of the broadcast or the telecast, you sent a telegram and you failed to appear. Now, is that what happened, Mr. Arnold?
That's right.
In other words, you just failed to appear.
That's right.
Mm-hmm.
But
Would you care to comment on that, sir?
I think if I am able to give you the background as to what induced me to come to New York,
yes,
you, as well as your listeners, would better understand my position as to not appearing on the program.
Well, we'd certainly like to hear your side of it, Mr. Arnold.
It was represented to me by a long-distance telephone conversation that the program, which was going to appear on the subject of UFO on the Columbia Broadcasting System television network, was to be an honest, straightforward program giving a clear, concise picture of all of the really important knowledge that has been gathered about this subject since my first report of June 24th of 1947.
Mm-hmm. That's the time when you came up with that term, flying saucer. You're the originator of it. Isn't that right, Mr. Arnold?
Not exactly, Long John. The term was actually coined by a United Press correspondent who put the question to me as, how did they fly? And I replied, they flew as if you would take a saucer and skip it across the water,
mm-hmm,
in a rough, erratic fashion. That's how the name, I think, became, as we look at it today, UFO or flying saucer.
Well, I still think, Mr. Arnold, you can take a bow for it. Well, let's get back into now. In other words, when you were planning to appear on the Armstrong Circle Theater, you were under the impression that you would be able to bring out all of the things that you had acquired as far as knowledge is concerned about this phenomena known as flying saucers since June 24th, 1947, right up to and including this day of January 23rd, 1958. Is that about the size of it?
To a major extent, it was, Long John, mm-hmm, except that being that the subject of flying saucers has become such a complex problem since the time I first made my report, it would have been impossible to project in a short time all of the pertinent facts that have been gathered. Though I was led to believe, and it was entirely at my choice, to appear on the program if I was satisfied that it was as it was represented to me in Boise, Idaho. The letter I received from these parties that induced me to make this long trip dated of December 31st of 1957 assured me that before I left Boise, Idaho, and I will quote from the letter, as soon as we have the first draft of the script ready, we will forward it to you. I never received a draft of this script, but was assured over the telephone that they wanted me to come and that they knew that I would be more than happy to appear. The program, there was no question as to the representation, and that they would discuss that with me when I came to New York and had a chance to see what was going to be portrayed.
Mm-hmm. Who signed this letter that was mailed on December 31st, 1957?
The letter is of on the stationery of the Talent Associates Limited, 41 East 50th Street, New York 22, New York, and it is signed by Mardette Edwards of the editorial department.
I see. So you decided, after talking to them on the phone, after receiving that letter dated December 31st, 1957, that you would make the trip to New York. In other words, you had confidence in them. Is that right, Mr. Ryan?
I had all the confidence that I could be assured of over the telephone, and though I've turned down many requests of this type, it seemed as though that this was going to be projected as represented, and I was anxious, of course, to see that the true story, as far as we know, was being portrayed for public interest.
Now, Mr. Arnold, when you did arrive here in New York, I assume that you went into conference with Mr. Robert Costello, the producer, and with Mr. Irving Tunick, the writer. Is that true, sir?
That's true.
And you saw the script that they had prepared for you?
I saw the script that they had prepared. Every participant in the program, it seemed, was continually changing everything in the script, so actually, no one, I don't believe, really knew what the final outcome of it was going to be.
I see. In other words, even after the second day of rehearsal, you were not confident that this was going to be the last and final draft. Is that right, sir?
Right.
Uh-huh. Now, when did you make up your mind that you would not participate in this program, Mr. Arnold?
I made my final decision, I think, about 1 o'clock of the day of the program of January 26th, January 27th, or 22nd.
January 22nd.
That's Wednesday, the day of the program.
Yeah, about 1 o'clock in the afternoon.
Yes.
Now, that's only a couple of days ago, sir. What actually made you make that last-minute decision at that time? Did you see a revised edition of the script that you didn't like or something?
The entire program had not actually been reviewed as of the day before it was to be projected. The Secretary of Research and Development for our government had never appeared, and we didn't know whether his script was going to be as printed or whether it was going to be entirely changed. And even the people that I talked to on the program that had to do with it were unable to give me a definite answer about that.
I see. I understand from Mr. Tunick, who spoke to me on our beeper telephone, and I think you heard that conversation because you were listening to the program.
Yes.
He mentioned about a telegram that he did not read, but he was aware of the fact that it had been received, evidently, by the producer, Robert Costello. I wonder if you happen to have a copy of that telegram with you that you could read to me, or if you feel that it's of a personal nature, certainly, Mr. Arnold, I wouldn't insist that you read it. I'd let you pass judgment on it.
I can't very well say that it is of too personal a nature because The telegram stated at least my principles as to some background as to why I was not going to appear on the program, and copies of this telegram were also sent to two of the large New York newspapers, as well as a representative of Newsweek magazine, Rod Gander.
Do you know if a copy of the telegram appeared in any one of the two New York newspapers? Are you...
That I don't know. The papers, they get out here. I'm not in New York City itself right
yes.
now.
Don't mention where you are either, sir, because I have not divulged to our listeners your phone number, because I know many of them who are fans of yours would like to be able to contact you, and I know that you'd like to get some sleep. So don't mention the town that you're in, please.
All right.
Now, Mr. Arnold, would you be kind enough to read the telegram to me?
The copy of the telegram that you have requested,
mm-hmm.
as the date and the time, was January 22nd, 1958, at 2:44 p.m. in the afternoon. It was sent to Mr. Robert Costello, Mr. Ivan Tunick, in care of the Armstrong Circle Theater, CBS Studio, 58, 841 9th Avenue, corner of 55th Street, New York. It is as follows. The persons or agencies who project information of national interest have a serious responsibility. A correctly informed public is one of the greatest assets this nation can have. This is to inform you that I will not be a participant on any program that obviously misrepresents and distorts facts available on any subject broadcast for the public interest, nor could I allow any photographs or material properly copyrighted to be used on any program without written permission of the owners. Signed, Kenneth Arnold, and there is a P.S. I am not making an appearance on any television program on January 22nd, 1958.
Well, I don't think you pulled any punches, Mr. Arnold. I was wondering if... I'm quite interested. I'm not really great at shorthand, but I've tried to make some... quick notes on this, just to question you about. I hope I have it down correctly. However, on the tape, it is correct, sir. You mentioned about not wanting to participate in a program that, I think you said, misrepresents or distorts facts.
Right.
I'm paraphrasing. Naturally, I'm not quoting you accurately, sir. Do you feel... that the program... First of all, did you see the program last night, sir?
Yes, I did.
Mm-hmm. And do you feel, after viewing the program, that there was a certain amount of misrepresentation and distortion of facts?
In this respect, mainly, you didn't quite read the part of the telegram as I projected it to you properly in this way. I said, this is the part of the telegram, this is to inform you that I will not be a participant on any program that obviously misrepresents and distorts facts available on any subject.
I see.
Now, in other words, I know a great deal of demonstrable facts on this subject that were completely ignored, even when I sent... to the studio, photographs and photostats of things that I know and could substantially prove to be true.
I see. Mr. Arnold, do you have any comment to make on the fact that Major Keyhole, the last part of his statement was cut off the air? Do you have any comment on that? Or are you aware of the fact that it was cut off?
Yes.
This was done intentionally, you know.
Pardon?
This was done intentionally. This was not an accident. This was not faulty equipment.
I realize that.
What do you think about that, sir?
Mr. Keyhole, as anyone participating on a program, is at a terrifically disadvantage, or a terrific disadvantage, I should say, due to the fact that you have to sign a release if you appear on the program stating that everything that is going to be stated, of which I'm sure Mr. Keyhole didn't know the entire story, because I don't believe anyone knew, at least I couldn't find out. He had to sign this if he wanted to be a participant. I refused to sign mine because I had not, as prearranged the agreement between the program directors and myself, given the opportunity to actually see the entire program projected before it went on the air.
Are you familiar with any of the details about Captain Repelt? According to many of the program listings in the newspapers, it was announced that Repelt would appear on that program. Do you know if he arrived in New York and possibly decided at the last minute not to participate in the same manner that you did, Mr. Ryan?
I don't know anything about Mr. Repelt. My impression, and I read that Clarence S. Childs, an Eastern Airline captain, was going to appear only by reading it in the paper. I think it was the Tribune. And I learned at the studio, I can't quote who it was that told me, it was one of the officials there, I assumed, that Eastern Airlines, which is, I think, managed by Eddie Rickenbacker, refused to let him come and be on the program. Now, that, of course, was just hearsay. I had no way of verifying it.
Mm-hmm. I see. In other words, then, I think possibly we could say that although we all believe in freedom of speech, evidently, freedom of speech is something that we can have after approval by the authorities.
Well, it looks as though that through no fault of my own, I have placed myself, or I have been placed, in a very precarious position, and I hesitate in making a remark on that. I don't feel in any way that I'm an authority on the principles of what is represented in our Constitution. I interpret them, I think, like lots of people, the best way I can. And my impression, of course, is that these things, anything that a man wishes to say, he has the right to say it as long as it in no way causes injury to anyone else, of which can be settled by due process of law. Now, my telegram in no way incriminates, I don't believe, anyone. I simply stated my principles, and my principles pretty well established my position as far as being a participant in a program that was for the public interest. And I wanted to be absolutely sure of the facts before I subjected myself as a representative of thousands of pilots to, well, what should I say? It wasn't whether Kenneth Arnold was important at all. It was the fact that I didn't believe that the program was treated quite fairly. And I don't believe that it probably was Mr. Costello or Mr. Tunick's fault in any way. It was just a circumstance that arose probably due to the fact that there has been so much controversy about this subject, if you know what I mean.
Yes, I'm quite familiar with it. Mr. Arnold, no doubt you heard Professor Menzel's comments about what he thought about pilots. Do you remember that comment?
Yes.
Would you care to say anything about it?
I received a phone call. How he got my number, I'm not sure, this morning.
From Professor Menzel?
No, from one of the prominent pilots.
I see.
Of one of the major airlines congratulating me on my stand.
Uh-huh.
And apparently, Mr. Menzel's ridicule of, or criticism of, indirectly, of course, of pilots who are responsible every day for hundreds, probably thousands, of our lives as we travel the airlines, wasn't too popular.
I can imagine. One last question, sir. I'm very, very appreciative of the fact that you've given us so much of your valuable time. Do you actually believe that the so-called flying saucers are interplanetary craft?
I don't think that you quite put your question properly.
Supposing you rephrase my question and answer it, sir.
Pardon?
Supposing you rephrase my question and answer it in your own way, sir.
What these things are that we are seeing in our skies, I don't believe it's anything to become hysterical about. Let me try to put it this way. If I can put it so that... The conclusions, if I were to come to any conclusions, which of course would have to be, I think, temporary on anyone that I know of part on this subject of things in the sky that are seen, would have to be based on the process of elimination, and that is that it has been pretty well demonstrated to me for nearly 10 years that it is not a product of our air forces or of the air forces or ingenuity of any other country on this globe. And the only conclusion that I could come to cautiously would be that it must be of an extraterrestrial origin. Whether it comes from another planet, as we interpret as planet, is something that I certainly couldn't make a statement, because that is something that I would be unable to prove.
Mr. Arnold, thank you very, very much for being kind enough to talk to me on the beeper phone. I'm only sorry that you were not able to join us on the party line in person during your stay in New York, but we sincerely hope that if you do come back to New York at any time, that you'll know that the welcome mat is out in front, and you're more than welcome to be on, and we'll be proud to have you.
Thank you very kindly, Long John. I'm sorry to have been so cautious, but I do feel the weight of responsibility in making a statement that would be incorrect, and I'm doing the very best I can.
Thank you again. Goodbye, sir.
Goodbye.
Well, that was the beeper telephone conversation that I had with Kenneth Arnold, the man that coined the phrase flying saucers back in the year of 1947. The way I said that, you might think I had that telephone conversation in 1947. Actually, it was in 1958. January 23rd, 1958, just a short time ago. Before we continue on with the discussion this morning, and I sincerely hope that maybe you'll call some of your friends and neighbors who are interested in this, because we are now talking about a very, very serious subject, and I think you heard the opening statement that Major Kehoe made about what would happen if we had members of the Air Force in the studio with us. We don't, so you can expect something very, very exciting. Let me first of all take a moment to talk about aches and pains. A drugless method that helps mental massage. And once you try the unit, this is Long John with the party line. Did I just identify the station? I did? Well, I'm so happy, so proud to be on WI that I've done it twice. And if I were getting scaled for it, I'd get another $7.50. So what? Tommy Reynolds, my producer out there, he got very concerned that I doubled up on the station identification. Say, let me just briefly remind you, send your name and address into... Now, we're going to be talking with Major Kehoe. That's Major Donald E. Kehoe, director of NICAP, National Investigations Committee on Aerial Phenomena. And for the people who would like to contact that organization, I might also add it's a non-profit organization. You are more than welcome to take advantage of this address. Just write to NICAP, N-I-C-A-P, NICAP. The address, 1536 Connecticut Avenue, Washington 6, D.C. Now, we'll be talking with Major Donald E. Kehoe, Jules B. St. Germain, Cortland Hastings, and Charles Leadham. Mr. Leadham is a TV producer and an author. But first, we're going to break away for a few minutes, maybe 5 or 6 minutes. We're going to enjoy a little coffee out in the kitchen. Incidentally, you know, we're not in New York tonight. We're out in the transmitter of WOR. That's located in Carteret, New Jersey. And we're going to be enjoying a little coffee and a little of a Danish pastry, and then we'll be back with
the beeper telephone conversation that I had with Kenneth Arnold, the man that coined the phrase flying saucers back in the year of 1947. The way I said that, you might think I had that telephone conversation in 1947. Actually, it was in 1958, January 23rd, 1958, just a short time ago. Before we continue on with the discussion this morning, and I sincerely hope that maybe you'll call some of your friends and neighbors who are interested in this, because we are now talking about a very, very serious subject, and I think you heard the opening statement that Major Kehoe made about what would happen if we had members of the Air Force in the studio with us. We don't, so you can expect something very, very exciting.
Major Kehoe is director of NICAP. He is also the author of a number of books on the subject of flying saucers, including Flying Saucers from Outer Space, published by Holt, The Flying Saucer Conspiracy, also published by Holt, and available in your bookstore. We have also with us this morning Cortland Hastings and Charles Leadham. And I understand that possibly in another 30 or 40 minutes that we'll have the pleasure of having Jules B. St. Germain, the attorney from Lynbrook, Long Island. He'll be joining us. Possibly some of you people remember the Armstrong Theater telecast. I think that that was viewed around January 22nd of this year. And at that time, Major Kehoe, it has been suggested by many, that his conversation was sort of faded out. Some people claim that they didn't have time to let the Major complete his statement. However, he was on camera for the entire time, moving his lips, and yet what he had to say was not heard. We've had opinions from people associated with the Armstrong Circle Theater. We've talked to them on our beeper phone. We've also talked with Kenneth Arnold on the beeper phone. And this morning we have the pleasure of talking with Major Kehoe in person. This is something we've attempted to do for some 2 years now. Major Kehoe, I wonder if you could first tell some of our listeners, as well as the gentleman sitting around the table here, if you could tell us what NICAP is.
NICAP is a non-profit private organization which is designed to collect and evaluate and make public all authentic information on unidentified flying objects or flying saucers. It has membership in 47 states, 14 foreign countries, and on its board it includes such distinguished citizens as Vice Admiral R.H. Hillencoder, who used to be director of CIA, Central Intelligence Agency, Rear Admiral Knowles, Colonel R.B. Emerson, Army retired, Major Fournet, who used to be the number one investigator on UFOs for the Air Force and the Pentagon, and a number of others. Scientists, educators, religious men. We have a panel of experts in various fields who help evaluate sightings and other developments. And then we try to cover these publicly in magazines and bulletins. And our aim is to try to get the subject out in the open and to get Congress to have open hearings so they'll finally strip away the secrecy.
You say, Major Kehoe, that you want the subject to be brought in the open. What do you think should be brought out there? Is there something that we don't know as citizens of this country?
There's a very great deal. In the first place, pilots in the armed forces, in fact, all members of the armed forces, are muzzled to a great degree in regard to sighting reports. The Air Force constantly denies this, but I have in front of me here copies of the official orders, JANF 146, a Joint Chiefs of Staff document, and AFR 200, that's an Air Force order, which says that no one will discuss any unexplained sightings. They won't release them to the press. Occasionally, there are leaks, of course.
What is your opinion about this, Major Kehoe? What is the reason that they're trying to silence these people?
Well, for a long time, the policy has been to explain away these sightings while behind the scenes they're very seriously investigating and trying to get all the answers. They're also trying to find the secret of propulsion so that we can duplicate it. I agree in the last phase that they're right in keeping everything they learn technically to themselves. But I think it's a great mistake to deceive the public, treat the American people like children, the way they did for a long time about the H-bomb. I mean, everybody was told that, yes, it was something, it was a little worse than an A-bomb, and they didn't let us know that we could be blown right off the map. And for a long time, missiles and submarines were in the same category. Now, right now, 40 to 50% of the country could be wiped out by missiles and subs. Now, that was hushed up for a long time.
Do you think that this country is in danger from the possibility of an attack by people who may live on other planets?
I've never thought so because the modern phase goes back 10 years into World War II, and they've had plenty of time if they wanted to attack us, unless it's a very, very long-range preparation. Of course, there have been a few accidents, and some people view those as evidence of hostility. But I think we're merely under observation, and it's taking a long time because they are probably having difficulty in understanding it and deciding what to do, if they intend to communicate.
Pardon me. What planet do you think that these UFOs are coming from? Or what do you like to call them, sir? How do you like to
call them? I call them UFOs because even though you'll find the word flying saucers in every book I've written, that's... because a lot of people don't know what UFOs are. They're gradually coming around to it, but it helps to make the subject a little more serious. It's a very silly word, a term, flying saucers. It's an unfortunate thing. If they'd call them discs, it would have helped, or unidentified objects. But a lot of people hate to admit they believe in flying saucers just because of that name. Well, I like to call them UFOs.
Well, first, let's take care of a little business. Possibly, Court, you'd like to get in at about this time. I know that you've waited for a long while to have the opportunity of talking with Major Kehoe. Is that a call you have now, Major?
Yes, I'll be right back if you can excuse me for a moment.
Go right ahead. I understand that there's a call that came in for Major Kehoe, and we hope that it may be something that will be of interest to our listeners, because... If we have something that we think that we may have, I think it will be of extreme interest to all concerned. Court, you've been a member of NICAP for quite a period of time, is that right?
Yes, I have, John.
And I was wondering if you could tell the listeners something about your personal opinions of NICAP, why it should remain in business, if that's the proper phrase to use, why it should continue to function.
Well, I think it's probably the outstanding organization, certainly in the United States, and I believe in the world, for the purpose of investigating UFOs or spaceships. I also prefer a term other than flying saucers, because it is a term of ridicule, a term which certainly does not is lend any commendation to the whole subject. The whole organization, John, of NICAP, I've been familiar with, in fact, considerably before Donald Kehoe became its director. I had known the previous director, in fact, the man who organized NICAP, but when I went to Washington to look into it, and at that time, former director had proposed that I be a director of the organization. Upon investigation of it, it didn't seem to be set up properly to do the job that it was supposed to do. And therefore, I sent regrets regarding the honor which was offered. And since that time, I understand the situation has been clarified. NICAP is on an extremely sound basis of operation. But, of course, NICAP naturally needs members to carry on its work. It needs money to carry on its work. And I feel that anything that's worthwhile is certainly is entitled to receive such. I think Donald Kehoe himself, John, has done a tremendous piece of work. He and his secretary or administrator treasurer, I believe is her proper term now.
Mrs. Campbell?
Mrs. Campbell, yes, whom I know, have done yeoman work. They have just really been slaves at it and have put far and beyond the call of duty into NICAP. But they need help. They need help of those who are interested in saucers and of people who perhaps may not approve the subject or perhaps not be as familiar with it as others may be. But it is certainly a wonderful idea because they are trying to find the truth out about spaceships.
In other words, you don't feel that the government can accomplish this?
Definitely, I do not feel that the government is even beginning to accomplish it, John, because this problem is in the hands, very much in the hands of the wrong agency, the Air Force. This kind of thing should be in the hands of another department of the government, perhaps the Department of State, better yet, a completely new agency, because we are dealing with something which is not known to physical science as to what the power is. It is not known to anybody here on Earth from where they come. That is, let's put it this way, it can't be proven from where they come, except that they don't come from this planet.
May I interrupt you for just a moment, Coy? Sure. What is coming? In other words, you say that the Air Force, or rather you say that science has no knowledge of where they come from, or what the method of propulsion is. What are you talking about?
I'm talking about the UFOs, the spaceships. We don't know what powers them. We know it's something.
But in other words, are you implying that we know that they're there?
Sure, of course. Without any question of a doubt. Mm-hmm. If our pilots of the Air Force, our commercial pilots, if thousands of American citizens, I probably could almost say hundreds of thousands, but let's be conservative and say thousands, can be believed. Now, granted, there are a number which are mistaken identities, perhaps even over half. But I would say that certainly a minor portion of the sightings, a major portion by the pilots, but a minor portion by the citizenry, could be termed as credible.
You feel that half of them are credible?
Of the citizenry? Or of the pilots?
Yes, of the sightings.
Well, the pilots, John, I think the big one. Oh, yes, because the pilots are men who know what is in the sky. Mm-hmm. They are trained to identify other aircraft, and their opinions are those of men who are learned in the subject of flight and ships which go through the air. Therefore, we could, I think, safely assume that their sightings would be very much more reliable than would the citizenry, and in many cases, they've been closer.
I think that Dr. Menzel, though, sort of blew that theory high, wide, and handsome when he was on the Armstrong Circle Theater.
Well,
he does not discredit the pilot as pilot. But the fact that a man is a pilot does not mean that he is also a physicist and an astronomer and a scientist in generaldom.
No, John, and I don't think that our physicists and astronomers at this point are geared in whole round fashion to judge these either, because apparently there is something beyond our three-dimensional science involved.
Mm-hmm. Charles,
however, The pilots, however, several have seen these at rather close quarters, that is, within several hundred feet, some within a quarter mile, some within a half mile or a mile, and some at a greater distance. But they are obviously not other aircraft, and they move at such fantastic speeds and with such maneuverability, such as taking sharp right angle turns, going at perhaps 1,000 or 3,000 miles an hour, or even reverse directions with no hesitancy. And that obviously is something way
beyond. Isn't that pretty slow? I think you've read them too, Court. Reports about UFOs being checked in some manner, and they claim that the speed is 7,000 miles an hour.
That is right, and I believe that Commander McLaughlin, I believe, of the Navy, had some tracking mechanism. I'm not familiar with the tracking mechanism, John, but at any rate, it was done for the purpose of checking the weather balloons, and they tracked a saucer at somewhere around 50,000 feet elevation, I believe, going about 18,000 miles an hour. So that has been the maximum speed. However, it's no different than our Sputnik or satellite, so.
Mm-hmm. Charles Leadham.
Court, a couple of questions. First of all, on NICAP, I've heard this term thrown around a great deal, and I can't remember exactly what it stands for.
National Investigations Committee on Aerial Phenomena.
Congratulations, John. I don't wonder. I have to stop
myself.
I'm
not going to kill anybody.
Good man. The second question, earlier you spoke about what NICAP was doing. And I think your phrase was they were trying to find out the truth about spaceships. Now, to me, this indicates a certain predisposition when you say to find out the truth about spaceships. Am I perhaps wrong in thinking that you are predisposed to there being spaceships? Or would you like to rephrase it and say to find out the truth about the object?
Oh, that's all right. It really doesn't matter much the term we use, UFOs, spaceships, whatever.
Well, it matters to me a great deal, because if a man comes to me and says, I've got a project to find out the truth about spaceships, then I say to him, well, you're already convinced they're spaceships and you just want to show it so. Isn't that true? And if he comes and says, I want to find out the truth about objects, then I assume that he's taking a scientific attitude and will accept reasonable proof that they don't exist. I'm not trying to put you
right.
in anything.
No,
these are spaceships and you want to prove that they are? Is that the object of NICAP?
The object of NICAP is to investigate anything, shall we say, from space. So I would put that in perhaps less definite terminology than I had phrased it. I didn't mean to try and pin it down quite that closely, Charles. Personally, I do believe in spaceships. I think that the overwhelming weight of testimony is so vast that there is no question, but there is much to be learned about them, because we actually know very, very little about them, other than they appear to come from other than earthly origin. In other words, are of extraterrestrial origin, that they go through our atmosphere at vast speeds, far in excess of our own aircraft speeds. They have maneuverability which we cannot have and don't have. I don't say cannot have, we may have someday, but we certainly don't have it now. Some of these appear to be construction, some appear to have landed.
There's one question which has bothered me about flying saucers and spaceships or wherever they are. And the maneuverability, particularly this right angle turn thing, which, if true, if something turns a right angle at fantastic speeds, 9, 10, 12,000 miles an hour, then they have got something there. But without attempting to penetrate the mind of the man who is flying this thing, the Venusian or Martian, if he wants to get from point A to point B, why in the devil would he fly a right-angle corner? I've never been able to understand that.
Oh,
I can do it. You know, I'm walking from here over yonder, and if I want to do a right angle turn, you know, I'm going slow. But ordinarily, I sort of go straight there.
Well, if they had to go from point to point, I venture to say they would probably go perhaps even a shorter distance than our own aircraft fly, because unless we're flying great distances, we don't go via the great circle route.
Mm-hmm.
But I don't know just why they make right angle turns, other than in some cases to avoid. For example, you will recall, I think, Charles, hearing the story by Jay Glick, who was on this program with us some time back. I had contacted Jay myself to, at the request of some others, because I'd never met the gentleman. And when I saw that he seemed like a very sensible person and had a very interesting story to tell, in fact, he's an extremely interesting person in his own right, Long John was kind enough to invite him on the program. And Jay was on the plane which flew to San Juan from New York. And just a little bit out of San Juan, this flying object, UFO, appeared to approach this plane coming at a tremendous speed. And it looked as though it was absolutely on a collision course. So the pilot, in order to avoid this, pulled the plane into an extremely sharp climb, threw everybody in the aisle, and bounced people off the ceiling and hurt some. In fact, I understand one of the people is still hospitalized. And Jay was thrown back in his seat very sharply, but it put him at such an angle that he had a better view to look out the window than they had when he was sitting upright. And he could see this thing, and it came directly at the plane, took a right angle turn, and took another one, went right back. And there was no hesitancy in any of these movements.
What do you think this proves, sir?
Well, it shows that it certainly was something that we don't have. It wasn't a meteor. It wasn't a fireball. It wasn't another plane. It had to be something which...
Why do you put that much confidence in Mr. Glick?
Well, it wasn't only Mr. Glick. After all, I think, again, we have to look at the pilot. The pilot is a man of many, many thousands of hours of flying. And he has seen probably all the different aircraft there are. And there is nothing which indulges in that kind of maneuver. Furthermore, there were no other aircraft right close by him, although seven other aircraft did see this object.
Well, unfortunately, I don't have anything to sell to Venusians or Martians, but I've got something that I'd like to talk to some of the Earth people about. As an individual, I don't buy the flying saucer stories, but I don't think you're interested in my opinion. However, I can honestly tell you this, that I receive, I think, almost every publication that is published in the field of flying saucers. And some of them are really great. But I can honestly tell you that I think that the NICAP publication is just about top. If you'd like to know more about it, you can write a letter or a card to NICAP. That's NICAP. 1536 Connecticut Avenue, Washington 6, D.C. I'll repeat that again. That's NICAP. NICAP. The address, 1536 Connecticut Avenue, Washington, Zone 6, D.C. Now, this is not a commercial. They are not sponsors of the program. It's only natural they cannot be sponsors because it's a non-profit organization. But I think that certainly the good bulk of our listeners, the great majority, should certainly be interested in NICAP, because it offers memberships and publications giving authentic UFO sightings, and I'd like to underline that word, authentic UFO sightings, and to update developments about unidentified flying objects. And if you'd like to become a NICAP associate member, it will entitle you to a year's subscription to NICAP magazine, the UFO Investigator, and to special or confidential bulletins as issued from time to time. So if you'd be interested, NICAP, N-I-C-A-P, the address 1536 Connecticut Avenue, Washington 6, D.C., District of Columbia. Major Kehoe, just as we were going to talk to you again, there was a call for you, a long-distance call. I was just wondering, was that a personal call, or was it something that may be of interest to our listeners?
Well, I think it would interest almost anyone who is interested in the flying saucer subject. This came from Captain Joe Hall of Capital Airlines. Captain Hall is a veteran. He's been flying 18 years, 16,000 hours, most of them at the controls of an airliner. Now, this is not a personal sighting of his, but it's one from a lieutenant in the United States Navy, and he checked on it and backs it 100%. Incidentally, Captain Hall himself had a sighting which was reported some months ago, a very strange one, as he was flying from New York to New Orleans. On this flight, he was also flying from New Orleans to New York, and this naval pilot, and we can't give his name, although I have it in front of me, because you have to request the man's permission before you can name him on the air like that. He reported this sighting. On December 11th, 1955, he and another Navy pilot were flying from Jacksonville Naval Air Station, Jacksonville, Florida. They were flying Cougar jets on a practice mission. It was a clear night, and they hadn't seen anything in the sky. Suddenly, they received an urgent message from the tower to fly directly out over the ocean, and they were vectored, that is, guided, on a certain course. They flew several miles on this course, and they suddenly discovered in front of them an object with an orange-red glow to it, which as soon as they started to close in, began to maneuver at very high speed. Now, each one of these Cougar jets was equipped with radar, and they picked up this strange UFO, or flying saucer, but they couldn't get a lock on. That is, the radar would not lock on and guide the planes automatically, because each time they tried to close in, this strange object would either accelerate to tremendous speed, or else it would climb up to a very high altitude. In fact, the altitude during the chase varied from 6,000 to 30,000 feet. And the speed varied from about as slow cruising speed as they could make with the jet up to near sonic, which is roughly over 700 miles an hour near sea level. They said during this chase, they were constantly receiving reports from the tower. Said by that time, the tower was filled with high-ranking officers in Jacksonville Naval Air Station, and that they were being tracked by radar at Jacksonville, which showed the blips of the two jets and the UFO as it was outmaneuvering them. They were also getting reports, telephone calls from people all over the area, so they had direct, authentic reports from more than 100 ground witnesses. Now, this particular report was checked by Hull. He found out the name of the other pilot involved. He said there is no doubt in his mind that this was an authentic sighting, and that the pilot told him that they felt absolutely ridiculous, because here they were in high-speed jets, and this thing was just making monkeys out of them. This may not sound as dramatic as some of the sightings that have been published, but if you stop and think, the men involved, the trained Navy pilots, and the man investigating it, a veteran airline captain, I think it should make an impression. To me, it's a very interesting case.
Major Kehoe, we have so many questions to ask you, and I know that I have dozens of them, but I think in all fairness, Charles, we'll give you a little chance for a couple of minutes anyway.
All right, sir. One question which has interested me, Major, is I believe you've mentioned several times that there is, to your mind, or at least to the mind of NICAP, a good possibility that these saucers are using perhaps Mars as a base of operations for observing Earth.
Yes, I said that.
And I think you said that one of the things which led you to believe this was that the incidence of sightings had increased every time Mars was nearby over the past maximum of 10 years.
That's right.
Well, the thing which makes me curious about this is if indeed these objects are interplanetary or perhaps inter-system ships, which so they must be capable of pretty fantastic range and speed and so forth, why would they even bother with a little thing like the extra distance across the solar system and just wait around until Mars happened to be a little closer to come looking at us?
Well, that's a very good question. Of course, we don't know the maximum speeds or the propulsion methods. It's really speculation based on sort of an educated guess. The first time that this increase was noted, it was just considered a coincidence. That was in 48. There was another very big one in 50, a very great one in 52, enough so that the Canadian government project decided at that time that they would make it official. It had been an unofficial deal until then. As far as the speeds are concerned, it may be that there are large units which do take advantage of the closeness of Mars to discharge smaller ones, which they leave in our area, operating, orbiting, perhaps even operating from the moon. I don't know the answer. It's mere speculation, as I say, but it is on record, however, that there has been an increase which precedes the opposition to Mars and lasts anywhere from 2 to 3 months afterwards.
On the subject of speed, I don't know whether it was you or Court who mentioned earlier that there had been at least one report of an object traveling at, I think, 18,000 miles an hour. Is that an official NICAP sighting?
That is one of which NICAP is aware. It's an official Navy sighting. It was referred to the Air Force. It was out of White Sands. As a matter of fact, it was Holloman Air Force Base. It was a theodolite tracking by trained observers who were checking a balloon and about to track a missile, and they sighted this object. It was certified by everyone in the group and was considered by the Naval Ordnance Laboratory, Corona, California. He's a guided missile expert. He says that he thinks that this thing was undoubtedly a spaceship, and he believes that they are operating from Mars. And he's still our high-ranking officer and is still in charge of the missile laboratory.
You mean the Air Force didn't succeed in having him broken?
No, he didn't.
Well, do you mean that, of course, that they tried to have him broken?
No, but they ridiculed the sighting, but they had nothing to base the ridicule on.
Well, Major, the thing, I'm not familiar with this case. As I, from what you said, I assume that someone who was tracking a weather balloon saw this object through the theodolite.
That's right.
Which, to my recollection, is a small sighting device, a tube or something with lenses in which you get an altitude and direction fixed on a weather balloon.
Right. It's usually a very good telescope, so it's not a...
And then, according to my mathematics, this thing which was moving at 5 miles per second, they apparently followed that across the sky accurately with this small telescopic device.
If you're a good theodolite operator, you can track quickly. They track guided missiles with those out of White Sands, too.
Yes, but I don't think those go at 5 miles per second, do they?
No, but they
That's from horizon to horizon in a couple of seconds.
This thing was not observed from horizon to horizon. It was picked up and observed until it made a very sudden, sharp ascent. And the thing that made the report impressive was the fact that the angle of fly was also calculated, and the G's involved were, I think, on the order of 36 to 38 G's. Accepted by the people at the base there, including the commanding officer of the naval unit, and that exciting because of the experience of the men involved.
Charles, you said that you went from horizon to horizon in a couple of seconds. I don't think that this is quite what you mean, because the Earth is 8,000 miles in diameter, and if this thing was going at 18,000 miles an hour, it would have taken, say, 20 minutes or so at least to make that traverse.
Well,
I think you're mistaken there, Court, because most theodolites are not able to observe from one side of the Earth to the other, at least not the ones with which I'm familiar. The ones with which I'm familiar are based on the ground and can see to the horizon, which is, from ground level 5 to 10 miles away. They cannot see around the curve of the Earth.
That's understandable, yes.
Well, now, how do you mean it took 20 minutes?
Well, I was trying to figure the 8,000 miles divided by 18,000 miles an hour.
Mm-hmm.
I was making it conservative.
Is it your understanding that the theodolite kept
the
object?
I don't know anything about the theodolite myself.
I'm tracing your own figures. Is it your understanding that the man, wherever it was, with or without a theodolite, tracked this object from, shall we say, China around to Russia, which would fit in with your statistics?
No.
Well, what was the 20-minute thing you gave me?
Because, I was simply dividing the diameter of the Earth, which would be some 8,000 miles, and assuming that 8,000 to be tangential to the surface of the Earth, one could see at that point in a straight line from a tangent point in either direction, which roughly we would call horizon to horizon.
Mm-hmm.
Actually, we don't see around curvatures, we know. So, at least it would be quite a number of minutes, which this thing would be in within vision.
Well, Cord, the thing I'm trying to pin down here, because this is a very interesting sighting to me, is I take it you are given to understand that the theodolite first picked this thing up when it was 4,000 miles away.
I don't know. I'm not familiar.
But maybe the people would be more familiar with it. You have some reference on that particular sighting, Major?
This is a briefing on it. I wouldn't have all the details here. It was calculated to be 56 miles above the Earth and flying at 5 miles per second, that is, you're correct, 18,000 miles per hour. It was elliptical in shape, and they computed the approximate size or length as 105 feet. Now that is the basis of that particular report. If I can find the rest of it later, I'll get it to you. But anyway, I do remember that. And the fact that McLaughlin added three other reports when he made this one public, and the others were not merely one unit sighting, was where theodolites had been tracking objects from various points in white sand, and also radar had picked them up. And in one case, there had been a visual and moving pictures film taken at the same time.
Mm-hmm. Major Keogh, do you think that the officials of the Air Force actually believe that there are UFOs arriving here on this planet, or at least hovering over this planet, that are coming here from other planets, from Mars or Venus?
You didn't say how many. If you mean the entire Air Force...
No, I certainly wouldn't want you to go on record to tell us what the...
I would say that there is a sizable group in the Air Force, and I know that the time when I was working with them, which was back in 52 and 53, there was a very good percentage that believed it, not only believed it, but thought the public should know about it.
Mm-hmm.
And there have been documents drawn up by Air Force intelligence officers stating their belief in that. And of course the most important one was the 1948 top secret estimate, which the Air Force for the first time tonight came out and denied. They denied because they were on the spot with that document.
Was that on the Mike Wallace show?
That's right.
That was where the denial was made.
That's where the denial was made. It was given to Mike Wallace. What happened was that I had tried to say that the Air Force had these documents. I tried to say that on the Armstrong program January 22nd.
Mm-hmm.
The Air Force representative, according to Mr. Irv Tunick, the writer for Armstrong, told him that that would have to be taken out, or the Air Force would immediately deny it, and even if it meant denouncing the source. The source, not me, but Captain Edward Ruppelt, who was formerly chief of Project Ruppelt. Now, Ruppelt had stated the existence of those documents in his book, which was cleared by Security Review of the Air Force. I checked on that. It was cleared December 5th, 1955. They did not want that statement made.
Major. Who didn't want the statement made?
The Air Force did not want it made.
In his book.
They tried to hold up his book, and they were told by Doubleday, the publisher, that if they didn't get it clearance within a certain time, they're going to publish it anyway. So they got it. But honest, they had refused to answer questions about that for a long time. I had my Senator Byrd ask them specifically about it. In one of 11 questions, Major General Joe Kelly, head of legislative liaison, evaded all our questions, including that one. Nobody had ever pinned the Air Force down until tonight. I had told Willis that I had this, had proof of it, and they said it was absolutely untrue. I showed a portion of the script in which this was marked right out, and anybody can identify that as part of the Armstrong script because it's in the same typewriter. You can see it. I've got all those scripts in my
Would you read that part of the script to us tonight?
Yes.
I'd like to hear that. While you're getting that ready, sir, let me take a moment to talk about one of our sponsors, and then we'll be back with Major Keyhole. We'll be able to hear Major Keyhole read the statement that he wanted to read on the Armstrong Circle Theater telecast. Major Keyhole, before you read the statement that you were not permitted to read on the Armstrong Circle Theater telecast, I would like to have you give me your opinion, if you will, please, on two questions. Number one, why didn't Ruppelt appear on that program? According to TV Guide, he was listed.
Well, that's right. He at first accepted the invitation. According to Mr. Tunick, the Armstrong writer, he was quite enthusiastic about it. And later he said he didn't realize he'd have to be there for rehearsals for 2 or 3 days, and that he just couldn't spare the time. That may be the exact answer. It's also possible that since he's with an aircraft company, that they decided maybe it was just as well not to let him on. But they did agree to let him on the I've got a secret program sometime before, so I assume that is the correct answer.
Mm-hmm. Now the next question, sir. Kenneth Arnold was in town. He was at rehearsals, I think, for 2 days, and he refused to appear on the program, and it was his opinion, and I have the telegram in front of me, a copy of it. He said in this telegram, "I will not be a participant on any program that obviously misrepresents and distorts the facts available on any subject broadcast for the public interest, nor would I allow any photographs or material properly copyrighted to be used on any program without written permission of the owners." You feel that Mr. Arnold was correct in that statement?
Well, I talked with Arnold quite a bit. I could tell at the end of the first day that he wasn't happy about it, and the second day that he was thinking of pulling out. And I happened to see him in the very instant he was checking out of the hotel.
Mm-hmm.
And I told him I thought it would be better if he'd stay on because it would look bad, you know, going getting into the Air Force. And he said that he felt that it was a rigged program, or that may not be verbatim, words to that effect. And he had wanted to state certain things, and they said there was not enough time for it. I didn't overhear his discussion with the writers and producers. But I knew that he was progressively getting unhappy about it, and he sent them that telegram. They got it about 4 o'clock in the afternoon. And of course, somebody else had to read his section.
Well, now before you read your statement, sir, I wonder if you can give me your opinion for the reason why did they even produce or even think of this particular show if they were going to run into so many problems? And certainly, the Air Force must have informed Robert Costello and Herb Tunick that they were not going to agree with you, and they were not going to let you just make any statement that you felt would be right to do.
Well, I can give you 2 or 3 angles on that. I don't know whether you may have seen these letters. But I go back to the first. They told me that I was the first one that they approached.
Now, you're referring to
the Mr. Tunick called me and asked whether NICAP would cooperate putting on a program on UFOs. And I said, yes, we'd be glad to, as long as we were given a fair representation. He said, well, we'd be glad to do that, and asked for advice. I gave him some ideas, and I was thinking at the time that it was going to be a panel discussion, I said, be sure to get the Air Force in there. He said, later, we're having a little trouble with the Air Force. I said, well, tell them that if they don't chance, swing it aside and they refuse to have anyone on. Whether or not that did it, I don't know. But anyway, he called back and said, the Air Force has now reversed itself and everything's fine. giving us full cooperation. But the first thing I knew, a script came down showing the Air Force had all of Part 2, and I had 5 minutes of Part 3, Rubel had 3 minutes, and Mentzel and the Air Force had the rest of it, which meant a balance of more than 3-1 in time. I kicked about it, and they said, well, you should have asked for equal time at the start, which was true, but I had thought it was discussion show.
Did they give you any reason? Why didn't they give equal time? Did they think that Nightcap would be entitled to equal time?
They said they felt that Douglas Edwards' presentation was more from Nightcap's viewpoint than the Air Force, that it was really on our side and that it helped balance it. I do say that he did give a very fair picture of it, but it was not Nightcap's story. And they said, well, we'll squeeze in a few more minutes if we can. Then Ruppelt backed out, and I got his time, and they squeezed in another minute or two. I think altogether I ended up with about 10 or 11.
Is this including the time that you were talking, that the pots were closed?
I don't know. It wasn't timed exactly. It was something like that. So then on Sunday before the show, I would talk to some of our Board of Governors, and they said, we don't like that script. It's entirely too weak. And I agree. And they said, well, we have these points. And we listed these four documents I'm going to tell you about that should be mentioned and other things. In the meantime, I had been told that the Air Force would not go on the show if there were going to be any personalities. And also, I was told that I could not mention the orders which muzzle pilots.
That's what you did mention on this program.
I didn't mention. I mentioned just now?
Mm-hmm.
That there are orders of Muslim pilots, yes, but I was told I couldn't mention that on that program.
And in other words, I'm pretty stupid.
No, you're open-minded. Well, we were in a spot. Anyway, he said, we'll do the best we can. But then I insisted on the change, so I completely rewrote the script that night, and the morning I got up there, it was in typewriting. I read it off at rehearsal with Doug Edwards, and it wasn't until either late that afternoon or the next day that the Air Force man discovered this business about these four documents. At that time, they, Tunick came over and said that they won't allow that to go on as is without protest. And they will immediately deny it and deny the source. Now, if you want me to, I'll read the statement now.
I sure want you to make it, yes.
All right, here is the statement. Which crossed out.
I want to read the opening part of that statement that we did hear.
Yeah.
Those people who saw the telecast, there may be some who missed it. And
all
then
right.
Tell us when you're reading the part that they would not permit you to do.
All right. I don't have a preceding page, but I can remember it. Edwards asked me what was the reason for the wide difference of statements between NICAP, myself. I mean, the Air Force says they don't exist, we say they do exist. And I said there could be two reasons. One of them was an honest difference of opinion among analysts. Second, there's an official policy believed in the best interest of the people not to confirm the existence of UFOs until all answers are known. And then this was supposed to follow. Captain Edward J. Ruppelt, former chief of Project Blue Book, has confirmed the existence of four important Air Force documents that should be noted. In 1948, in a top-secret estimate, ATIC, that's the Air Technical Intelligence Center, concluded the UFOs were interplanetary spaceships. In 1952, an Air Force intelligence analysis of UFO maneuvers brought the same conclusion, interplanetary. In 1953, a report by a panel of top scientists at the Pentagon reached this conclusion. There is strong circumstantial evidence, but no concrete proof that the UFOs are spaceships. They recommended intensifying the investigation and telling the American people all the facts. Now that is the part that was cut out. You'll notice there are only three documents mentioned. Just before that, apparently to save space, Tunick or someone had cut out the 1947 document which said that these things were real, whatever they were. Now,
wasn't this on the teleprompter issue?
No, it was not on the teleprompter because for 2 days we rehearsed with scripts. I think at the end of the second day they were under the teleprompter. I mean, I would make the statement, the Air Force was calling Captain Ruppelt. To avoid it, I was afraid that I'd be out of it completely clear, and it looked as though
I saw that telecast, and two readings from a... In other words, that,
oh, that was
a
telephone. Yeah, yeah.
Each second was the telephone.
At the fact that the Air Force had too much time from representatives, that we had been one that they were considering possibility of, and if I put that in there, we thought it would be terrific. But I understood later that he had no authority to, and what I should have done was gone to Bob Costello, the producer. I still hadn't made up my mind. We went on the air, we got to a certain point, and I just stuck in the committee.
Mm-hmm.
As soon as I came over Bug Edwards, some people did hear it.
But that was what I was trying to... Well, I hope that you'll tell us something about the thing discussion that we had this morning.
Right.
I think you mentioned on that telecast, and it's what you read or met particular evening, but I think...
Yes. Well, you read the Crawling Subcommittee, which is the permanent...
Mm-hmm. That's the committee that
that's
you
the committee, yes. Finally said, don't, please get along with mail. But after the answer, I wanted to verify it, I think, the fact that there was, so that he could make it authentic. I mean, I had told him.
I see.
About the committee without naming it. And he did a little guessing and called out, and the chief counsel said, yes, we've been making a preliminary check before we decide on public hearing.
Mm-hmm.
On that, that was, of course, the thing that I tried to say when I was cut off. Incidentally, you asked about the teleprompter. I had two or three more paragraphs on there in which I said that I urged anyone who had information on UFOs and was withholding it, that is, good verified sightings, to send them in to us, either openly or confidentially, and to if they were interested in the subject, to write to us, and we had our address in there, everything, which you've been so kind to mention here. As soon as I started reading this, the teleprompter began to rack up and down so fast, I couldn't read it. So I knew by then that I was in disfavor somewhere. But I finished as quickly as I could from memory, and they had left me on camera.
Yes, they did.
And at that time, they switched to Doug Edwards. But here's something I'd like to make clear. I want everyone to know that I never blamed Armstrong or CBS. The writer, Tunick, and the producers, Bob Costello, were the nicest guys I have ever encountered on a TV program like that, and, well, anywhere on any network. And they did try hard to offset the lack of time. I felt particularly bad because Costello was so worried about the effect. And I stuck around there for an hour and a half to talk with any newspapers that called up, in spite of the fact several people said I want everyone to know that I never blamed Armstrong or CBS. The writer, Tunick, and the producers, Bob Costello, were the nicest guys I have ever encountered on a TV program like that, and, well, anywhere on any network. And they did try hard to offset the lack of time. I felt particularly bad because Costello was so worried about the effect. And I stuck around there for an hour and a half to talk with any newspapers that called up, in spite of the fact that several people said I went away and left everybody in the dark about what I was going to say. But here is a statement of CBS.
If I may interrupt
yes.
you for just a moment, Major, also in talking about Robert Costello and Irv Tunick, I think it was about 3 o'clock in the morning, the following morning,
mm-hmm.
I talked with Mr. Tunick,
mm-hmm.
who was trying to get me on the phone. And our switchboard was pretty well tied up that morning because naturally a number of people that saw the telecast thought that maybe we would have some knowledge of what she tried to say.
Mm-hmm.
So Mr. Tunick sent me a wire, and then I had him on the beeper phone, and he told us what had happened down there, and he was extremely complimentary about you, sir. And he said that you were very cooperative and you appreciate it.
Oh, I appreciate
that. Right on the
I hated it because they'd both been so friendly, and they did not. I don't think either one of them liked this, but it's about the censorship. And also, I understand that under CBS rules, that they had to pull a switch on it.
Mm-hmm.
So that's okay, and I did sign a statement to that effect. However, I didn't mention the censorship that happened before then because I thought, well, if I do that, it will look as though I did this for that reason,
mm-hmm.
that I did it in order to get that thing in the newspaper. So I purposely kept quiet about the censorship that the Air Force had caused during this time. It would have been a wonderful time to spring it. and show that piece of paper from the script, but I didn't. I just waited because I didn't want to hurt Costello and Tunick anymore. I thought they might be blamed for having something, some knowledge of it. But here is a line that CBS said in a letter, a form letter they send to everybody about the program, says, this program had been carefully cleared for security reasons. Therefore, it was the responsibility of this network to ensure performance in accordance with predetermined security standards. Now, I would like to know why, if the flying saucers don't exist, if they absolutely are no menace of any kind, and they couldn't be, they simply are something, the product of imagination of their errors, why there is security about it, and why the program had to be cleared at all. Why was it they were so worried that I might say something? And also, I venture to say this, if the Air Force colonel had started to ad-lib a statement in there, I wonder whether they would have pulled the switch on me.
I can't answer the question.
I'd like to look back about 50 to 1 that they wouldn't have.
Well, you're a betting man, Court. I'm not.
If you want to get around to it later, I know I've talked quite a little bit here, there are some other items that were in the original manuscript set up there.
Well, no, I would appreciate it very much if you'd like to comment on them right now, sir.
All right.
Because the listeners would naturally be very interested in these.
All right. Now, this, I don't say that this was censorship, because they could actually, unless they'd given me even time, they couldn't have covered all this. I was hoping that they would actually be forced into giving me equal time with the Air Force, which didn't happen. Well, one of them was the case of Indianapolis, where practically half the city saw an object in 1952, and a statement by Captain Richard Case, who was flying an American Airlines Convair, said that this was a controlled craft of some sort, and he was perfectly convinced. Then I had a military case by Marine Corps Captain Don Holland, and the fact that his sighting was confirmed by Major General William G. Manley, USNC, who said he did sight it, and that it was an authentic sighting. Then I mentioned the fact that many Air Force pilots among the hundreds who claim the UFOs are real. And I thought I had in here the Far East Air Force report of an encounter in December 1956. And incidentally, that was described in our magazine, The UFO Investigator. There's an Air Force jet pilot caught this on his radar, and the book showed it to be as large as or larger than a B-29 bomber. And he locked on with his radar and tried to close in. He saw this thing ahead of him, strange round object, and this was later computed to be at least 200 and 250 and perhaps 300 feet in diameter. He closed to within 5 miles, and during that time, he had a mysterious radar interference in the object. He kept switching frequencies, and after a few seconds, the interference would come back. When he got to within 5 miles, his object accelerated to between 1,500 and 1,800 knots. That's roughly around 2,000 miles an hour, and went out of sight so quickly that he just vanished. Now, that was cut out. I was argued against using that one because you can't use the pilot's name. Well, the Air Force will not release the names of witnesses in any case. I think it was a good one. I think the reason it was cut out because it would have put the Air Force on the spot. I also mentioned the fact that Senator Barry Goldwater, an Air Force Reserve Colonel, has said that he frankly feels there's a great deal to this, and he had often discussed it with Air Force officers. Then I mentioned the documents, which I've already gone over, and the Mantell case, let's say it in, the Mantell case. I mentioned that also in 1948, the pilot of an Air Force T-6 had had a weird dogfight with a strange UFO over Andrews Air Force Base in Maryland. And after trying to close in for 10 minutes, he switched on the... In spite of that, the Air Force came out and released a public statement that this man had been dogfighting with a balloon. Now, that's another thing that was not on the air. Most of the other has to do with sightings. Oh, there was one other thing, Special Report 14. That's the Air Force Blue Book report, in which they say that they analyzed 3,201 cases, and they had in the back of this, it shows a table, that 19.5% were unexplained. In other words, if you add on the ones that they hadn't explained on up to date, it makes a total of more than 700. They admit 5,700, so 700 out of 5,700, or more than 12%, are unexplained. And the Air Force admits that, but they come out and say,
we are currently explaining 1.9%. And the word currently gets dropped out, and everybody thinks the Air Force has explained about all but 2% of the sightings. I had that in there, and part of it was left in. The one other thing that I wanted to mention was the fact that the Air Force said that they could not build a working model of a flying saucer because they had 12 cases out of all these, which they called the cream of the crop, and they all of them were describing different objects. And this is by the fact that in 1949, Project Grudge report was released temporarily and later was classified. And it said that there were several groups. Group 1, the most numerous, described a disc-shaped object, apparently metallic, which had a diameter 10 times the thickness of the object. Because these things were capable of swift accelerations and high-speed turns. The second group was luminous objects seen at night, and the third group was cigar-shaped objects. Now, you certainly can make working models out of a disc or a cigar-shaped object. So here's Special Report 14, which was apparently let out to deceive the American people. And this was denounced shortly afterwards by Captain Ruppelt, the former head of the project, who said that he was responsible for having this thing drawn up, and when it came in, everybody agreed it was practically worthless and is still being put over as the official document of the Air Force.
Major, there's a question on these documents. These four top secret documents seem to keep coming in and out of all the conversations on this. Now, to my understanding, you knew of the contents of these documents through Captain Ruppelt. Is that correct?
And others.
Now, earlier this evening, the Air Force, through Mr. Wallace, denied that three of these things ever existed and stated that the fourth document did exist, but that its contents were pretty diametrically opposite to what you claimed. In fact, they claimed, I think it was a statement of Secretary Horner, that in fact, the contents of this document were that the public should be widely informed, true, but they should be widely informed that there was no evidence to support the hypothesis that there were flying saucers or spaceships or what have you. Now, earlier you said that on the Armstrong Circle Theater they did not want to get into this because the Air Force would deny the existence of them and would in fact be calling Captain Ruppelt a liar. Now, can I assume that the Air Force has now called Captain Ruppelt a liar? Through its statement of earlier this evening?
It would appear to me that they had, yes.
Mm-hmm.
And that raises quite a number of points because he's not the only one who confirmed the existence of these documents.
Mm-hmm.
I learned of the existence of two of them a long time before his book came out. Now, there's a very funny thing about the one they do admit. This was not an Air Force document solely. It was originally an investigation, or rather, an examination of evidence by scientists called together by the Central Intelligence Agency. They ran the show with the Air Force producing the evidence they had. And these top-level scientists and aviation leaders, astronomers and so on, were called in to advise the Air Force what to do. Now, the one recommendation in there, which is very important, is that they said you should quadruple the size of the project and set up special observation posts.
Mm-hmm.
Now, that's one thing that people in the project have been fighting for. Ruppelt mentions in there that Major General William Garland, who was then out at ATIC, came to the Pentagon and fought for this and was finally turned down. He wanted it carried through, the thing quadrupled and the observation posts and so forth. It'd be very easy to call Garland and Colonel Dunn, Frank Dunn, and others Ruppelt mentions in there, and it's interesting to note that nobody mentioned by Ruppelt in that book has ever come out and said, that's a lie.
Mm-hmm.
And copies of that book went to every officer in there who's mentioned in it. There isn't any question that those things exist, but the minute the Air Force admits it, then they are on the spot.
Well, with them finally having denied it, it seems that it is no longer a case of perhaps concealing things from the public, but it is now pretty much a flat case of somebody, either Captain Ruppelt and the other gentleman, or the official representatives of the Air Force are just plain lying?
Well, I don't like to use the word lying. Here's what I would like to say there. There are people who think that it is wiser not to let the American people know any bad news.
Uh-huh.
That's been prevalent, and it's more and more prevalent in Washington today. Big Brother will decide what is best for the American people, and I think it's wrong. Now, when I say I'm speaking for most of the people on our Board of Governors, and you could say, as Wallace started out saying, well, everybody connected to this seems to be a crackpot or something else. Now, we have Vice Admiral R.H. Hillencarter, as I mentioned. He was formerly head of the CIA. He had a wonderful war record. Rear Admiral Herbert Knowles, also a fine war record. Colonel Robert Emerson, USAR, who occasionally goes on active duty for the Army today, investigated this for years. J.B. Hartranft, who's president of Aircraft Owners and Pilots Association, the largest organization in the world of private pilots. Major Fournet, who was on the project, and the number one man in Washington, number one investigator. Quite a number of people. Well, Frank Edwards, you just mentioned him, mm-hmm. identified him a while ago, and some religious leaders, the Professor Maney at Defiance University, and we have a number of other people who will not let their names be used, but who are special advisors in various fields, some of them top rocket missile men. These people, most of them, will agree that the Air Force is keeping facts from the public.
May I ask you this, Major Kehoe? You've given us a list of names here. Would you go on record here this morning and make the statement that all of these people whose names you have just listed to us, would you say that they all believe that these UFOs are interplanetary?
No, I won't say that because there's a variation in there, and I do hope to have a statement on that out within the next week or two. At least there will be a statement by a majority of the board on this question of censorship. Some of the board members, and I think it goes up to more than 50%, believe that these things are interplanetary. I'm not going to identify them until each one has given me permission. Some of them are absolutely convinced of it. Some of them say it looks like it, and they're almost convinced, and others say I'd still like to see some more evidence.
One quick question, and then I'll have to take care of a little mm-hmm. business, Major. Are you representing NICAP this morning, or are you talking as Major Donald E. Kehoe?
I'm representing NICAP, and anytime you want my personal views aside, it's a little hard to split myself
apart. I don't.
What I have said up to now is as a director of NICAP.
Fine. Yeah. Let me take a moment to talk about a wonderful opportunity for you. I think just at the time that I interrupted to take care of a little business here, you were telling us you were giving us some additional information about what occurred on that telecast, and also you were giving us a statement in reference to whether you were representing NICAP this morning or representing just Donald E. Kehoe. I have one brief question to ask you, sir, and then there's no doubt my other panel members around here have a number of questions, too. I heard the interview, I saw and heard the interview with Mike Wallace last night, and I noticed when the name Menger and Adamski was brought up, you gave a very, very quick answer. You were not interested. I think that was your answer.
Well, I'd like to qualify that for this reason. I had an answer ready for that particular question.
Mm-hmm.
But I had been under the impression that the commercial break was in the middle of that show, and that I still had, would have after that, 10 minutes or so.
Mm-hmm.
So when the commercial break came up, and one of the program officials came over and said, you've got 3 minutes after this line, and he'd already had the question on the line there.
Yes.
And I thought, good heavens, I was getting ready to really lay some hot stuff out, including some documents and letters I was going to read. And so I thought, I'm going to dispose of that as quickly as possible. It was not with the intention of sounding
hard-boiled, because I immediately tried to add that we, our policy has been one to examine all the evidence, and we have written all of the chief contactees and asked them if they would send in the evidence and if they would attend public hearings, take lie detector tests, and so on. Now, that answer should have been said, no, I don't accept it, the board doesn't accept anything, because we don't think anyone has presented verified evidence.
Mm-hmm.
But I was rushing through trying to get to my main points before Mike Wallace could cut me off, and that's why it sounded very explosive. It was not meant as an insult type of answer, but it was meant as an emphatic, quick answer to get on to before my 3 minutes were gone.
Mm-hmm. Well, I hope you realize that you'll have plenty of time to give us some of that information. Charles, did you want to pick up something here?
There's one small point, Major. I noticed that earlier on television and just now you said you offered these gentlemen, the presumed contactees, the opportunity to come to Washington, or perhaps someone will go there, I don't know how it would work, and take a lie detector test.
Mm-hmm.
And if I were if I had a story about contacting the Nugents,
mm-hmm.
and were told, in effect, that my story would stand or fall on the result of a lie detector test, I think I would quite justifiably turn it down, too, because, mm-hmm. as you know well, these are not exactly reliable instruments. They are not admitted as court evidence, I don't believe. Is that true, Jules?
Generally speaking, they're not admitted as court evidence. Of course, the question of reliability, you'll get various opinions.
Mm-hmm. But as long as there are at least a few expert opinions on non-reliability, I would hate to have my whole story fall on the fact that something went wrong with the polygraph when I happen to be tied to it.
Well, if I understand the Major correctly, I believe this is merely an incident of one of various tests to be applied and appearing before a panel. Is that right, sir?
That's right. There was a question that was suggested as one of the eight. In fact, we had originally about 20, and it just got to be too long, and cut it down. Now, I don't know how I would react if I'd had a contact, and somebody said to me about lie detector tests. I would check very carefully into who was making the test,
mm-hmm.
and perhaps to see there were two or three people there, and that they were in no way connected with the military, and I would insist that one of them not be connected with NICAP. I merely wanted to get the reaction of these people to see whether, under certain conditions, they would accept it, or whether, and also whether they'd come for public hearings.
Had anybody accepted it, sir?
If I remember correctly, two people did. One of them was Angelucci and Van Tassel.
Van Tassel agreed to submit to a lie detector.
I will have to check, but my memory is to that effect. I think we have it in the magazine here. We printed the replies that we got.
But what happened?
Well, the point is this: we had stated that if whenever NICAP was able to have these hearings, it's going to be an expensive proposition to transport somebody from the West Coast and to put them up there for whatever time it takes for these hearings. And I also have always said that I felt the investigation of factual sightings should come first.
This is WOR Radio, your station in New York, 710 on the dial. Major Kehoe, don't you think, though, that that's a rather unfortunate situation? In other words, let us say as an example that I one night come in front of this microphone and I say that I was driving down the Jersey Turnpike and I saw a light in the sky and something landed near the side of the highway and it was a Venusian spaceship and I took a ride in it. And of course, I do this show and there'd be some people would believe me and many people wouldn't believe me, the same as any of the others. So immediately you hear about it and you send me one of these forms to fill out. And I fill it out, and I agree. Yes, by all means, Major Kehoe, bring the lie detector test up.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, you possibly sent this form maybe to 40 or 50 people, and I am one of three people who've agreed to submit to the lie detector.
Mm-hmm.
The outcome of it is you don't have this available at the present time. Wouldn't you say that this would sort of imply that I am honest and that I'm telling a legitimate story because I'm willing to submit to it?
I wouldn't say that implies that 100%.
No, not 100%.
There are a lot of people that will agree to anything because they are convinced of what they are saying. You know that sometimes a man can be so convinced of the truth after he said it enough times that he might even be able to pass a lie test. I've been told
that. That too, yes.
I think that's possible. The whole thing was unfortunate. I did not want to go into this contact business so soon because I felt that your first job is to convince the American people and the press that these things are real. After that, the other things in the right order.
Don't you think that's the easiest way? And believe me, I'm not being critical of you, sir, or NICAP. I'm not in the position to be, and I don't think it's my right to be. But you sit here, Major Kehoe, and you tell us about these sightings, and they're extremely interesting. And, of course, you have no tangible proof to afford us this morning, except the fact that this pilot and that pilot and this Air Force general has made the statement. These are fine and dandy, but don't you think it would prove more to the American public that there is something to this story if it could be proven that these fellows who claim that they've been talking to Venusians and Martians, if it could be proven that they're telling the truth? I don't buy it myself, frankly, Major.
All right, I'll try.
It would be easier to sell me the idea that this is something that
happened. I'll try to answer that. Before I do, I want to make one little correction in there about not having anything tangible. There are photographs, and there are photographs of radar scopes showing triangulation of objects, and there are pieces of metal which have fallen from objects which have disintegrated and which were reported as UFOs just before they did. So I would say there is some tangible evidence. Now, to go into this other, I know quite a number of veteran newspaper men and a number of newscasters in Washington. I said, what is your opinion? What's the best policy for NICAP after I was put in there and inherited and sometimes wish I'd never been born? But anyway, I said, no matter what you personally believe, it is smarter to concentrate on your factual sightings because the minute you start in on any other angle, you're going to lose the press. Then you will start being ridiculed as having accepted contact stories, whether you accept them or not, the minute you start sounding as though you do. He said, the best advice we can give you is not even to mention them. Don't say yes or no, just keep still. So I tried that at first. It didn't work. The pressure built up because there are many people who are sincerely convinced that these things are true. And some people who accept all of them. And some people who accept a few. The pressure got so great that I was accused of clamping a lid. Here I am, a guy trying to expose censorship, and I'm clamping a lid on the contact story. So I said, all right. So I got advice from a lot of people about a policy. And we set out these questions, and we did not send them to a lot of people because we selected the best known ones. Mm-hmm. There are by now, I think, hundreds who claim contact or communication here and abroad. So it didn't satisfy anybody. There are people that don't believe in them that wrote in and said, what are you bothering with those for? What's the idea? And we thought NICAP was a factual organization. The people who believe in the contacts wrote in and said, here you are trying to force people to take lie detector tests. The result is it's no better than it was. I will say this. I have tried very hard, and tonight perhaps is the first time that I have said anything that sounded a little hard-boiled. I've tried very hard to say we are going to be impartial. If anybody can bring in absolute proof that will convince not me, but the advisors and the board, that will be right out in writing with a NICAP banner on it.
Fine. Charles?
Major, on the business of the contact stories, I think the advice of the newspaper men that you consulted was probably good, and I bring up my own case very briefly to lead up to the question I want to ask you, is that years ago when the books and sightings first started coming out, I bought quite a few of them, read them, and had, shall we say, an open mind on it. I don't know if I really did, but I started to get off the boat very quickly when I read stories about glowing Venusians with long hair leaving hieroglyphics in the sand and a few other rather, shall we say, curious incidents. And I figured, well, if the flying saucer people are like this, well, who needs them? Now, which leads up to the question is, I wonder if perhaps you as the director of NICAP, or perhaps just as Donald Kehoe, private citizen, feel that the contact stories are damaging your case.
I think they are delaying acceptance of UFO reality by most people in the United States. And I said that in a statement of policy in, I think, our second issue. I said, no matter what you believe, why don't you take it easy and let's prove that these sightings are correct. Take the most factual ones you can get, and once the newspapers buy it and the networks buy it, the individual broadcasters, nothing can stop investigation of every phase, everything, the communication claims, the contact claims, every angle of it will immediately be explored, because then it will be the biggest story they've got, and they'll jump on it. You'll have thousands of people writing them and talking about it from then on. So let's get the facts in there. And that's the one thing the Air Force is worried about. They love the contact stories because it helps them to laugh it off. Now, there may be somewhere or other, there may be a guy with a contact story that is absolutely 100% true and he's being crucified. I will admit that in my book, particularly the second one, I took some cracks. And I treated the subject very lightly, and if I were to write another one now, I don't know what I would do. I probably would state the NICAP policy and keep my own opinion out of it, feeling that I should.
What I wanted to get in here, as a matter of fact, I hear the resonant voice of Jules coming in.
I have a squeak in that, Charles.
Sorry, the squeaky voice of Jules, is that this is an introduction to you, by the way, Jules. Thank you very much. Major, as you, I don't know whether you would call CSI, I'm sure you wouldn't call it a rival organization, let's say a fellow organization in the field, civilian saucer intelligence. And as we are on this subject, it is my understanding that CSI, either as a body or that a large number of its individual members, believe in what we have, I think, incorrectly called little green men and been corrected to little men.
That's right, not little
and,
green.
And here sitting on my right is the president.
A little man?
Is a little man.
Oh,
Jules, thank you, man. Are you as a representative of CSI tonight, Jules, or just as a member of CSI?
Individually, as a 230-pound little man.
He's tightly packed.
Jules, I wonder if you could recap briefly for some of the listeners who may have joined us for the first time, the statement that you made a couple of weeks ago on this program about the opinions of two of the gentlemen who head the research department of CSI. I think that's Mr. Ted Blocher and Mr. Lex Mebbin. I think you told us something about not little green men, but about little men.
Well, I hate to quote someone else. I think there has been a differentiation by CSI in the contact claims, putting one in the class of the fair-haired or long-haired Venusians or Martians with the metaphysical and the religious and occult significance, and the stories of the generally non-communicative little men who are more of the humanoid variety. And although I don't think that either class is endorsed, I think it is the position of CSI, generally speaking, or possibly the majority of the members, my phraseology may be poor, that of the two classes, there is more likelihood of truth in those stories which embrace the humanoid group, which we call the little men. Now, I hope I'm quoting the general position correctly. If that is my personal opinion in any event.
Charles, any further question or comment?
No. The one line of thought here which has occurred to me, and I can certainly direct this at either CSI or NICAP or just about anybody else in the flying saucer field, is that there are a lot of statements quoted about scientists' speculation on the fact that other worlds are inhabited, and statistically it seems to be a fair chance that a good many of other worlds throughout the universe are inhabited. And CSI and NICAP and the various flying saucer people say that there are such things as flying saucers, that very possibly they come from some unspecified, or perhaps more than one unspecified, other world far away in the universe. And the also there are statements about top secret documents, which may or may not exist. We don't know. We have conflicting testimony on that. But all of these things, it seems to me that the people who claim it are on the long end of the stick here, is that nobody, it's an easy thing to maintain. And I don't know if this is necessarily any condemnation of it, but it is unfortunate that those of us who are on the other side of the fence, who do not believe in saucers or little men or contacts or anything else, are not going to be able to have a final word on this thing until that great golden day when the Earth spaceships have explored each and every last sun in the universe. So we're on the short end of it, and they're on the long end of it, and it's perhaps just providentially very fortunate for them. And I don't know whatever we're going to do. The question that all this is leading around to, all this circuitousness, and it is circuitous, is that in these presumably open-minded and scientific investigations of saucers and contacts and little men, if there is anything that would prove, I assume that their minds are open one way or the other, maybe there are, maybe there aren't, if there was anything that would prove to the representatives of these organizations that in fact there were no such things as flying saucers, before we visited the last sun in the universe and said nobody home. I leave that wide open. Anybody can come in that wants to.
Well, I mean, I understand what you're saying, Charles, but I don't quite understand your point.
Well, my point is this. The civilian saucer intelligence and NICAP represent themselves, and I'm sure they are, as open-minded scientific groups wanting to investigate this thing right down to the last rivet of unidentifiable metal falling from the sky. But they only seem to be investigating it in a positive sense. They want to prove that it is so. And most of the things which I consider as scientific investigations as an open-ended thing both ways, we make an hypothesis and we say, well, now maybe this is so and maybe it isn't. We are now going to find out. And there are certain criteria. In other words, we will apply certain tests to something that we are testing. If this test works out this way, then the hypothesis is wrong. If the test works out the other way, the hypothesis is right. Now, of course, the obvious way of proving that your hypothesis is right is that the little man, or perhaps the long-haired man, walking into the studio or something and saying, "Hi, kids, I'm from Venus," and proving it. Is there anything which would convince any of you people that there were no such things as flying saucers?
Well, I might say, first of all, it seems to me that you're presupposing a blind acceptance upon the part of NICAP and the CSI of all UFO stories. In that respect, I think you're wrong. Now, just what Major Kehoe said in reference to the policy on the contact claims, that would seem to me a highly objective approach. They're not accepting it, they're asking for a proof.
Uh-huh.
They're asking if the party is willing to undergo a lie detector test. So certainly I think there it would contradict you. When you get to the question, of course, of tangible evidence, I think that's a term that can be open to various interpretations. To make a parallel example, it certainly is an exaggerated one. I've seen the top of the Empire State Building, but I've never touched it. Does that mean that it is possibly a fantasy? Of course, I realize that's exaggerated. It's not strictly comparable. But in tangible evidence, when you see definite and solid blips on radar, to me that would certainly approach, if not actually, being tangible evidence.
Of what?
Of some object in the sky. And if I have no authority on radar, the major commands are better than I. The radar scope indicates a speed in excess of that which can be accomplished by any aircraft known to us here. That would indicate that it is something of an unusual origin. Then the next question, of course, is what is it? I think basically there are three classes. One, spaceships. Number two, the secret weapon, and three, a little advanced theory that is some type of life form in the air. Do you know of any other classes, Major?
or theories?
No, except the Air Force answer is that the radar men are always wrong, or something's wrong with the set. But you have to rule that out when you take the hundreds of radar reports and realize that the men who make them are the ones who either GCI, Ground Control Intercepts in the Air Force, and are trained to guide fighters in very closely to enemy bombers, or they are civil aeronautics experts, including the men who can bring you in right down to the runway, and you don't see anything almost till you're there, and they can say, you're 5 feet to the left, over, down five, up four. I mean, they spot you instantly. If those men aren't able to recognize the difference between a solid object coming in under control and a bird or a temperature inversion or something like that, they'd be cracking up planes all over runways, and you wouldn't be having airliners flying in under low ceilings in the airports. Now, those radar men are good, and they very, very much resent the Air Force statements that radar doesn't prove anything. Now, they've even got Air Force radar now 3,000 miles that's supposed to pick up an enemy missile. And they're wonderful. They just say, oh, that's great. One is good. Why isn't the other any good?
One brief question, Major Kehoe. You have made the statement a couple of times this morning that you feel that the government is acting as sort of a big brother. They're going to tell us the things that they think that we can stand to hear, and the things that we shouldn't hear, they're not going to tell us about. Now, in other words, what you've implied is that they possibly know as much as you do, maybe even a little bit more about these things that are flying around, and possibly they know that they're coming from other planets. You sort of implied it anyway. Mm-hmm. Now, my question is just this. Is it possible, sir, that maybe some foreign government, I'm talking about a government on this planet, that maybe they've developed something that acts like UFOs? And maybe our government is familiar with the fact that it may be something that was built by Russia, and that they don't want to tell us that because they're afraid that it may cause too much concern.
Well, that, of course, was the first answer that the Air Force and the Navy and the Army considered back in 1947 when they had the mass sightings.
Mm-hmm.
There were a lot of scared people running around the Pentagon when these things finally seemed to be real. And then they began to take some stock and said, well, either the Soviet has had a terrific leap here, and less than 2 years since the end of World War II, and they're devastated factories, and practically nothing, and all of a sudden they've got a perfect global weapon, or else these are coming from somewhere else. So they did a hasty intelligence job. The end of 6 months, with the help of the British, they had ruled out any possibility this could be Russian. But now, just to say for a minute that they were Russian, it would mean that since 1940, actually, since the middle of World War II, the Russians had something in operation. Or maybe it was the Germans, and the Russians took it over. And then they perfected it by 1947. For 11 years, they've been building ordinary jets and working like mad to build missiles and get Sputniks in the air when they already had the ultimate perfect device and weapon. They were letting us fight them when all they had to do was to take one of these things and say, we are going to have it over the center of Wichita, Kansas tomorrow, and everybody better get out of there, because when we have it over there, we're going to drop something. And they could prove it without any doubt, and they would have owned the world by now. I don't think there's any possibility of a Soviet answer. And the U.S. secret weapon answer rules out the same way, because we wouldn't be so afraid. We would certainly not have failed to put Sputniks in the air, and we would not be building ordinary jets and missiles.
Mm-hmm. Cortland Hastings?
This problem of these constructions coming from other countries here, Jessup brought out the point in a letter to open letter to Arthur Constant in the Flying Saucer Review that in 1882, when...
Pardon me, who's Arthur Constant?
Well, he's quite an English scientist.
He's a what, sir?
English scientist. Yes.
Is that the gentleman who, is that the book published by Citadel Press?
I don't believe so, but I don't
it
know.
Is this a gentleman who claims that he feels that Adamski has legitimate pictures?
No.
No. I'm sorry. No. Continue.
But at any rate, there was a very great structure seen in the air, a UFO, in 1882. So this is long before any airships. And this is attested to by at least three prominent astronomers at the time. And your friend Jay Glick, as a matter of fact, going way, way back into history, Jay is quite an Egyptologist, stated that there were numerous references in the Egyptian Book of the Dead to spaceships as machines from space. So these things have been around here for so long that it isn't anything recent. Except
well,
that
if I may use the same reasoning that Major Kehoe just used in reference to the possibility of Russia having developed something back in 1947, and by now they would have dropped the bomb at Wichita, Kansas. Why are the Martians or the Venusians flying around with these things for the last 1,000, 2,000 years, or 400 years? Why haven't they done something instead of continuing to fly around? By now, don't they know enough about this planet?
Well, it might be that they're simply keeping us under observation.
For what purpose?
Simply to see what way we're reacting. Simply as possibly older people might watch some kindergarten children reacting. I don't know why they're here, John. I have any more idea than you.
You say you don't know why they are here. In other words, you've implied that they are here. Is that right, Court?
Well, I feel very sure that they're here. I don't think there's any question about it.
Who are they?
The people that UFOs, intelligently controlled, have been seen by the thousands, probably tens of thousands in our atmosphere, mm-hmm. by credible witnesses. I think we're always in these discussions, I don't mean just here, but discussions everywhere, about UFOs. People seem to get away from the fact, or not want to accept the fact, that pilots and very fine, sound citizens have seen these in such vast numbers that there's no longer question as to whether they are. As to what they are and from where they come.
I see. In other words, then what you're saying, Card, is that you don't know what they are or where they're coming from, and you really don't. In other words, do you actually feel that there's a possibility that some of these things have landed on this planet?
Yes, because they've been seen to have been landed in this last issue of the UFO Investigator put out by NICAP. There were several instances where the UFO was on the ground or hovering. Well, if you want to say landed, where the one was touching.
The fact
it was in Leatherland, as I recall, in that vicinity. Wasn't there one case reported of a UFO being in the middle of a road and the driver of a car having stopped, got out, and then it took off? There had been a landing case there.
Well, that was the Leatherland case. No, the Leatherland case, it was said that it came low over them. And the altitude was variously guessed up to, I'm not looking at it this moment, but as I recall, around 200 feet was the lowest altitude that I read. Now, the Alamogordo case was nowhere near that close to the ground.
Well, wasn't there one where I believe a truck driver from Waco, Texas, had actually stopped his motor vehicle and there was a egg-shaped object on the road in front of him? I had that impression.
That was down in Mississippi or Alabama or somewhere, and that's the one where he describes occupants that came out and talked with him.
It wasn't the one I had in mind, Major. I may be entirely wrong there.
No, you're not, Jules. In the Scoffers magazine, in regard to this Leatherland, Texas, Major, I will quote here because it's only a few lines. Pedro Saucedo, a farmhand, and Joe Salaz were driving toward a farm at Pettus, Texas. Saucedo suddenly spotted an object rise from a field and come toward us. Then his truck motor died and the headlights dimmed out. Pedro Saucedo jumped out of his truck. He said, "The thing passed directly over my truck with a great sound and a rush of wind. It sounded like thunder and my truck rocked from the blast. I felt a lot of heat." The enigmatic craft was torpedo-shaped. Well, that was in essence the report there.
As a matter
of
fact, I think it were from the earlier Air Force cases, the case of a musician by the name of Squires, I believe, in Kansas, which was, I believe, dubbed reliable by the Air Force. I think this man described an object on the ground, and he thought he sighted someone through a porthole.
I thought it was hovering a very close distance from the ground.
I think you're right there, but it seemed to be hovering very close.
Well, that was it. It was about dawn, or just before dawn, and I talked with one of the officers on the project about that. Now, maybe he was wrong. He gave me the wrong impression, but he said that it was hovering very close to the ground.
Some time ago, Major, I had some correspondence with Mr. Reinhold Schmidt in Kearney, Nebraska, and I received a 6-page letter in answer to a letter I had sent him. And I do have the impression, though I may be entirely wrong, that NICAP had sent him a letter or a questionnaire, had contacted him. Do you have any recollection of it?
No, we did not send
him. You did not?
No. In fact, I think there was some confusion there between a man in Washington named Wayne Aho, because I received a call from a radio station or a newspaper out there wanting to know what we had asked Mr. Smith, and I said, we hadn't asked him anything. And he said, well, he said that the head of this Washington saucer group had asked him. I said, well, chances are it's Aho. Sometimes the names are confused.
I assume there's no relationship between Mr. Aho and yourself.
No, he spelled his name A-H-O.
There's two Ahos. There's Major Wayne Aho and there's Arthur Aho.
That's
a brother who's associated with General Arthur.
That's right. I remember there was one.
I might add, by the way, I did also communicate with the prosecuting attorney in Kearney, Nebraska, with the unusual name of Gotobed, G-O-T-O-B-E-D. Unfortunately, I don't have the letter with me, but I was interested primarily in the claim of mistreatment, so to speak, of Schmidt. I don't have the letter with me, but the idea basically, as he expressed it, was to save Schmidt from himself. He thought he might have suicidal tendencies, so he was put away by a psychiatric board, which frankly didn't make much sense to me.
I think this is entirely false, Jules, that John wants to make.
I'll have to take it for a moment anyway, gentlemen. This is WOR Radio, your station in New York, and this is Long John with the Party Line. You know that we all have a lot of questions, and we want a lot of answers, so if we can get brief questions, maybe we'll get a lot of answers from Major Kehoe. Charles.
Well, this one is a double question, actually, and I...
You mean a two-for-one?
Two-for-one.
All
for one price, and it's both at Major Kehoe and at court. I don't know what the NICAP attitude is towards these, or I shouldn't call them prehistoric, these early sightings, Egyptian sightings, and who knows, Babylonian sightings, and so forth, the flying saucers. This is the second time I've heard court mention the Book of the Dead of Egypt and its sightings of saucers from outer space. And the thing that the first part of my bargain question here is, I don't know, when was it, in the 1700s sometimes, the 1600s, there was a well-documented case in London of hundreds and perhaps thousands of people seeing flights of angels over the city. And there have been, throughout the ages, great, wonderfully documented, many thousands of sightings of, trolls and gnomes and elves and kobolds and so forth. And there's a mythical beast, I can't remember, which was seen in Central Europe by thousands of people, which had the head of a chicken and the body of a snake. I can't think of the name of it now, but if it looked at you or you looked at it, you turned to stone. There were a great many sightings of this. And speaking of sightings by competent people, the observers of the sea, sailors, captains, people whose entire lives had been spent watching the sea and objects therein, and were certainly as competent as anyone else, saw sea serpents, and who knows, maybe there are sea serpents, but they also saw a lot of mermaids. And I think we're fairly well convinced now that there are no mermaids. Now, the thing I want to know first is why court or the NICAP or whoever it happens to be select out of this great mass of curious stuff the sightings of objects in the sky, which are supposed to be from outer space, and throws them at us as being from the Book of the Dead. Correct?
I'm very glad to answer that.
Thank you.
I'm glad you can.
I'll answer as best I can. The Book of the Dead is instruction, actually, for people on this earth. It isn't instruction, as the name would indicate, for people after death. In the olden times, antiquity, in the times of antiquity, the term dead then meant life on this earth, and that the human soul is much more alive in the unseen than it is here on this earth. The reference definitely was to machines from space. It was not to be confused with the sun, because these things were referred to as machines, although having brilliant light. See, there have been many explanations that these were suns they were referring to. Well, they had brilliant light, but they were machine suns. In other words, that they were constructions, they were entities. I don't mean entities in the sense of people, but were things which were coming to their earth. And there were many references, too, to occupants of these machines from space. It wasn't just the machine alone. So I think that we've got to look at that in as broad a fashion as we can, with as open mind as we can. Now, your reference to these other sightings, Charles, where people saw peculiar monsters and all that. We know that superstition naturally does play a large part. On the other hand, for example, if we come up to a little more modern time, say in around 1880, I believe it was, somewhere in that neighborhood in Kansas, there was a UFO which hovered over a city, I believe it was Kansas, for about 3 days. There's a picture in the newspaper. After all, there are thousands of people, in fact, all the inhabitants of the city saw it. And they didn't see it for just an instant, or 2 seconds, or 5 minutes. It was there for days. So these things, I don't think we can laugh off nor discredit. And I think there's too much a tendency, just because our officialdom doesn't admit these things, to say that there's no reason for it. To me, the biggest problem and the biggest source of worry is the attitude expressed by the Air Force. I share Donald Kehoe's feelings 100%. When they state, or when he is on his Armstrong Circle Theater, says that there might be an honest difference of opinion. Of course, that is obviously not true, but the second point was that they might be to the best interest of people not to confirm UFOs until all facts are known. Well, now, if that is the case, neither should they deny them until all facts are known. Anything less than this is distortion. The Armstrong Circle Theater was an example of what distortions the Air Force causes where officialdom is concerned. Now, the Air Force has many times alleged that it wishes to avoid panic. I believe it is doing the very thing to bring on panic by not telling the American people the truth. I think the Air Force has far exceeded its authority, certainly if we hold our Constitution to be the guide by which our Federation is run. The Air Force is supposed to defend the United States. The Air Force is not supposed to make rules. We have three departments in our government, the legislative, executive, and judicial. These duties and responsibilities were most carefully defined by our forefathers. And because of this wonderful separation of function, I believe is the reason the United States has progressed to the fantastic point it has. Now, however, in the field of security and nuclear weapons, obviously the military must maintain secrecy. But once secrecy is maintained, and a certain unit of government has the ability to control completely all these functions of government, here is where we get into a very bad situation. The Senate document, or the publication, the United States Constitution, issued in 1948 by Alexander Wiley, chairman of the Committee on the Judiciary of the United States Senate, writes in one paragraph, "The Constitution has value not only as the guiding political instrument of our land, but also as a guide in the economic, social, and religious life of the nation. The basic principle of the Constitution is that of checks and balances, of division, rather than concentration of powers." And he goes on to say that power corrupts in whosoever hands it may be, and that absolute power, whatever its form, corrupts absolutely. And I think this has been demonstrated very clearly by the Air Force attitude. The Air Force is not a big brother. The Air Force group in Washington have constituted themselves as a group of censors to determine what the American people should know. Now, this was a thing during World War II. During World War II, we fought against a nation which was dictatorial, which was run by one man and a group under him. This group determined what the German nation should know. We have a more contemporary group in Russia which determined what the Russian people should know. This is against all American basic concepts of freedom. And I believe that our citizenry should go to their senators and representatives and have them exert all the influence possible on the government and on the Air Force to release all information which is not critical national security, and flying saucers certainly are not national security. This is information that belongs to the people of the United States. The people of the United States are the judges, not the Air Force.
I hesitate, Court, to ask the first part of my omnibus question again, but why is it that you choose to put more credence in Egyptian flying machines than in, say, reports of mermaids?
I don't recall that any reports of mermaids were made in the Book of the Dead.
Is that your sole source of authority in this world, the Book of the Dead?
It is a tremendous book of the Egyptians. One of the greatest books. The Bible happens to be another book.
Well, I'll let that one go by for a while.
It seems to me, Charles, that to a certain extent, your point is well taken.
Thank you for a certain extent.
Well, by this time, it seems to me superfluous to a great extent to rely on these ancient reports going back to the Middle Ages and to alleged biblical references in the Book of Ezekiel or the like, when we have as late as 1880, which is fairly contemporary.
I go along with you. Well, this is only background.
Yes.
I think we can concern ourselves only with today.
That is right. I believe it was in the 1897 and 98 where some craft was sighted over Oakland, later over Chicago and numerous cities that seems very, very tangible evidence. But in connection with the Air Force, I'd like to ask the Major if he has any idea why there apparently has been a change in policy. I assume there has been a change from the early 50s to the present time. Would that be due to personnel entirely?
No, it was due to the fact that one time one group was a little more powerful and then somebody would be transferred and then another top-level officer would come in and throw his weight. The policy at first, 1947, was one of bafflement and let's see what's going on. And then they began to suspect what it was and put it under wraps. And then near the latter part of 48, there was some talk about putting it out. And that got knocked down. And then everything was completely under wraps for a couple of years. And they began to get open again. Let's get serious about it. In 52... they finally decided, let's get it out and tell the people, even though we don't have proof and full answers. And in 53, they almost got away with it, and then it was knocked down, but hard. And from then on, the censorship has gotten tighter and tighter, to the point where they will even contradict things that they have put in writing before, and you put them side by side. It's obvious one of them can't, one of the statements can't be true. In fact, that's shown up here the very time of the Armstrong theater deal. Here you had on the Armstrong theater, you had Assistant Secretary Horner say it's a mistake to believe that the Air Force is withholding anything, and I do not qualify this in any way. And now that was the 22nd. On the 23rd of January, Captain Gregory H. Oldenburg, Langley Air Force Base, Virginia, wrote a letter to one of the NICAP members who had asked if he could submit an advertisement to run in the Langley Flyer. That's the base newspaper. And all it was say, we'd like to hear from those interested in forming a local affiliate of a National Investigations Network on the origin of flying saucers and UFOs, with the public dissemination of the data so obtained. And this captain says, and this is on Air Force Stationery, I objected to the running of this ad because I felt that it would encourage Air Force personnel to violate present Air Force policy and specifically Air Force Regulation 200-2. Within 24 hours after the Air Force Secretary says, nobody's hiding anything, here's a man comes out and writes it. Not only that, at the bottom of this, after turning down a much weaker advertisement, he says, although the wording of these two ads has been changed, it is my belief that one of the objectives of your organization is the public dissemination of data on unidentified flying objects. As I pointed out to you on the 20th of January, this is contrary to Air Force policy and regulations. Now, that's on record. Now, here's a man that says if you get the policy and regulations to disseminate any data, the Assistant Secretary of the Air gets on and says we're not hiding a thing. On top of that, Major General Kelly writes a letter to NICAP in which he says, you will note that this release reaffirms the United States Air Force position as to the non-existence of flying saucers. Shortly after that, he wrote a letter to, well, it was quite a little after that, to Senator Goldwater, asking about my being knocked off the air, and that was answered by Horner himself, in which he says, the allegations of the Air Force withheld information on UFOs are entirely in error. Who are you going to believe, and why?
Well, Major, is very pertinent to this. You mentioned several times the Air Force regulation, I think, 200-something or other. 200-2. And I wonder if perhaps the wrong interpretation may not be being put on this. I am not at all familiar with this, but here is how I might reconstruct the thinking of the Air Force in issuing that and in this gentleman's refusing this ad. Because I should think it would be very logical for the Air Force to desire that its personnel hold down to a minimum any discussion of objects they see going around the sky, with the thought in mind, one, that the objects that they do see might be secret, experimental, and so forth, American craft, not flying saucers or anything related to them. And if the boys see a few things zipping around and they get together downtown in the little room behind the bar, and in comes the local barber and the local spy and so forth, and they talk over these things, say, Jesus was going 9,000 miles an hour, and it made a right-angle turn, and it spit green bolts, and so forth. And here they are, all unawares, of course, with certainly no subversive intention, hashing over possible secret developments of the American Air Force. And this is only one reason I can see for them being a little reluctant to have their personnel going around talking up all the things they've seen in the sky.
Well, that I can see your reason for thinking so, but if you had examined all the Air Force documents, you would know that they specify there's a difference. When they talk about UFOs, they specify that these are entirely different from ordinary missiles or aircraft types. The Navy says the same thing in its order. This particular one, here's the way it reads. relates to any airborne object which, by performance, aerodynamic characteristics, or unusual features, does not conform to any presently known aircraft or missile type.
Well, doesn't this exactly describe a perhaps experimental American thing?
They don't test experimental devices along airways, flying around airliners, getting so close to them that they scare the pilot to death and sometimes cause people to panic, as we did down in Brazil. The whole formation of these things, if we're flying those things around Brazil, we're not going to have any friends in South America left. And they've been, you don't have them flying over cities, you don't have them buzzing aircraft, flying head on at them and scaring people to death.
Well, Major, the thing that I want to get at is that this was not directed, this Air Force regulation was directed, as I understand it, to all Air Force personnel.
It was directed to all Air Force personnel.
And not just at personnel who happen to be stationed on or near populated airways or who happen to be stationed in Brazil. They don't want them, as I might reconstruct, they don't want them talking up anything they see flying around for fear the guy who happens to be on base or off base at Alamogordo may spill something. And I certainly don't think they could say this only applies to people around Alamogordo, New Mexico, without automatically spilling it themselves.
They do have special instructions down there at those places, and most of the people that are down there understand what is under test. We haven't anything. We have no round aeroforms 100 feet or more in diameter, which can be tracked on radar up to speeds of 7,200 miles an hour over airports, which have been done. It's on record, Washington Airport, triangulation by three radars. Flying around, buzzing airliners and everything else. But the point I was talking about in this regulation is that it says in here, right in the back, about release of facts. It is permissible to inform news media representatives when the object is positively identified as a familiar object. For those objects which are not explainable, only the fact that ATIC will analyze them can be released. In other words, if you can explain it away, tell the newspapers. If you can't explain it away, keep your mouth shut.
I'd like to ask you one question, Major Kehoe. You mentioned earlier this morning that you felt that possibly the Air Force told the producer and the writer of the Armstrong Circle Theater that certain material should be deleted from that telecast. This was your impression. Am I right, sir?
Yes.
Am I misquoting you?
That's what I was told.
Yes, all right. If this is true, and I have no reason to believe otherwise, why is it that I can sit up here 7 nights a week, and I certainly don't want to appear to be an egotist, that this is a great, important show to the nation, but nevertheless, it is available to a lot of people. A lot of people can listen to it because we cover 27 states.
Mm-hmm.
And how is it that no one came over to me and said, or sent me a wire or a letter and said, John, when you have this fella Kehoe on tonight, don't let him say anything about the Air Force. Don't let him say this, that, and the other thing. Now, there's no secret that you were going to be on here this morning, sir. I've announced it all week.
There's a very good reason. You don't have an Air Force representative here. The minute you get an Air Force representative in this room, I am censured. You're not going to be able to let me speak freely here.
I wonder if Charles is one of these folks.
Maybe.
The Air Force was on that program.
I
made it semi-official, and they didn't dare let anybody.
I'm glad you clarified that. Jules B. St. Germain.
I was going to ask you, Major, I'm going to lengthen my name because he gets so much billing just by saying
that
name.
Gentlemen?
There's a disadvantage, too, after all, by the time John has stated my name in full, I forgot the question I was going to ask originally. That's the case now. Major, I was going to ask you, I know I think you've been in television several times and on the air. I've been interested in this idea of a television program and planned on the presentation of a series. Do you not feel that this type of program, whether it be on radio or television, with a spontaneous and, well, a unrehearsed aspect, is not far more interesting to the public than one which is more or less canned and rehearsed?
Well, I should think so, depending, of course, whether you're going to include sightings. I think discussions will hold in this for a while. I think you're going to have to include a number of dramatic cases and dramatic developments in a series of that kind. People won't listen entirely to discussion. If you could have, say, one interesting new case, or bring up one that hasn't been well known, or examine an old one that is well known and get some new information on it, you'd have a program.
Yes, but the point I'm making is particularly, I enjoyed the Armstrong Circle Theater very much, but the rehearsed aspect seemed to me to detract from what could have been a more interesting program. I didn't know if you thought the same way.
Oh, I wanted it unrehearsed, but they said absolutely Air Force would not go on it for anything like that.
I had been hoping that I could see you tangled with Professor Menzel, which I'm sure would have been very interesting. I wanted to tangle myself when I heard him speak. Very frankly, prior to that broadcast, I had not shared some of the harsh sentiments concerning the Air Force. But I consider their presentation on the Armstrong Circle Theater a direct insult to my intelligence. It was not only ridicule, it was distortion. And nevertheless, I found in speaking to people the next day that apparently the Air Force impressed the average listener.
Right.
If the people I spoke to were the average listener, although to me it seemed the most ridiculous double talk. Now, how about you, Charles, as a objective individual? What was your reaction to the Air Force presentation?
Unfortunately, I didn't see it, Jules. So
well, he's secret agent number one of the Air Force.
In fact, wrote the script for the Air Force on that, so I'm not qualified to judge.
One thing particularly, though, which I thought was a little unfair. Colonel Whedon, who represents...
Whedon, that's right.
Yes. He referred to one particular case near Hopkinsville, Kentucky, which I'm sure you're familiar with in its basic details. And the presentation there was such as to directly invite ridicule and augmented by the fact that he claimed that this particular sighting, and this is a little man case, so to speak, in the broader sense, happened after a spirited meeting, which to me would indicate that it was some type of religious meeting that threw the people off completely at a tangent. As I understand it, there are, I believe, somewhere 11 or 12 witnesses, professed witnesses at least, to this particular occurrence. In your research, did you come across anything that would indicate that this particular happening, the little man happening in Hopkinsville, was induced by any type of hysteria or induced by religious meaning?
I am sorry, I'm going to have to admit that I'm not prepared to answer that fully, because while we have some information on it, I know that other people have more. We're trying to collect more on that, because at first I thought that it was probably just another wild tale, and I found so many people that were taking it seriously that we'd better look into it a little bit more. So couldn't give you an honest answer on that. That's the first time I ever heard of that, though, when the Air Force sprang it. And even if it were true, the way it was said was such as to cast discredit on almost anybody who might report such a thing. They spent a lot of time on the contact stories in that particular case, ridiculing. Whereas they could have, if they'd only held it down a little bit, we'd have had more serious discussions. They could have canned theirs, or condensed it into half of the time.
Well, then the Armstrong Circle Theater, too, Major Kehoe, as you know, Ken Arnold had two pictures by the Air Force, which had been given him as official photographs, and they would not permit him to show them. Whereas they did show ones of their own. And he had statements, too, that he wanted to make, and they were not permitted any more than they had permitted you to make statements.
Well, I heard that, but I wasn't present during any of the discussions, so I wouldn't know it of first-hand knowledge.
Well, I talked to him personally.
Well, he told me that, but I mean, I wasn't there. I didn't hear the discussion. Mm-hmm.
Charles?
Major, there's been a lot of discussion, particularly from you, about Air Force suppression of facts on flying saucers, and And I call to mind when I hear you speak of this, a case which was presented to us here several months ago, which was outlined in a book called They Knew Too Much About Flying Saucers, in which there were supposedly three men in black. I don't know why they should happen to be in black, but if what you have to say is true, they would, I should think, be from the Air Force, who approached a gentleman who was an editor or a head of a flying saucer organization who said that he knew the secret behind the flying saucers. They visited him and apparently put such a scare into him that he has since that day refused, I think, even to say the word flying or the word saucer. And what I'm wondering is, seeing as this thing so closely fits what appears to be the NICAP idea, suppression, perhaps intimidation, censorship, if you feel there's any connection between...
Well, I'm sorry, I have to interrupt at this time. Before Major Kehoe answers that, I know that you're referring to the book They Knew Too Much About Flying Saucers. This fella Bender, and they claim the three men came up in black and stopped him. He doesn't talk anymore.
No, I don't think so. Of course, that's merely a personal opinion without anything to back it up.
You're familiar with the story.
I'm yes, perfectly familiar with it, and I've heard all sorts of speculation as to why he might have decided to stop publishing, if that were not the exact reason. And I don't want to do him any injustice because I have never talked with him personally. I can only say this, that if any three men in black come to see me, they're either going to have to have some sort of threat that I can't visualize now, or some awfully powerful credentials. Now, I've advised our members and anyone else who is threatened about talking to ask for credentials, the name of the order under which they are operating, and someone, a witness in there, to take notice of the whole thing so there'll be a matter of record. And I personally don't know anything that would give anyone authority to tell you stop talking about flying saucers.
I have heard some stories, Major, about the Air Force having been given, I don't think the word seized would apply, various films of alleged UFOs and that having been returned.
Oh, yes, that's true.
Has that been substantiated?
Yes, that's true. I know one case where that's happened. And, but that's not the same thing. And usually in those cases, the Air Force asks for the original. And in one case that I know of, because I was right in the middle, I helped handle it, they said they would give the man a copy or two. When he got the copies, he swore up and down they were useless and demanded the original back. I don't know whatever happened. In that particular case, I'm not sure that these things were bona fide UFOs. They looked to me like fun dogs. But regardless, he didn't get his original back last time I heard from him. But this other thing, there's something supposed to be sinister about three men dressed in black. I personally don't find it sinister unless they're undertakers or something like that. But
that's not sinister.
Huh?
That's just the
end. I don't know. But anyway, no one has ever tried to silence me, except in one case where they tried to argue me and not writing it, into not writing anymore about that I split an infinity there about flying saucers. That was done in the open, though. It was done in the office of General Sorry Smith, who was then Director of Information at the Air Force. I had a one-man press conference with Major Jerry Boggs of Intelligence and two, three others, and they tried to convince me that everything that I had heard was wrong, and would I now stop talking? When they got through, I said, no, I'm more convinced than ever. You people are sitting on something. I said, well, then we've wasted our time. But nothing else. No threats.
Gentlemen, I'd like to make this suggestion. In talking with Major Kehoe a few days ago, he was in Washington at the time, and I contacted him by phone, and he said that he didn't think it would be possible for him to appear on the program this morning because he had to be on the Mike Wallace show last night, and he felt that he would be too tired. He's been working a number of hours every day and has had possibly an average of 4 or 5 hours sleep a day for the last few months. And after talking to him for a while, he agreed to come on for about an hour to an hour and a half. Now, it's 3:15, so he's been with us for 3 hours and 15 minutes, and I appreciate it very much, and I have no doubt that everybody sitting around the table will share my enthusiasm and agree with me that it's been very kind on the part of Major Kehoe to join us. Now, I think in all fairness to him, we should leave him get a little sleep, but let's take a little more advantage of him and keep him here for, say, about another 15 minutes, and I'll give each one of you gentlemen an opportunity to talk with Major Kehoe for about 5 minutes. So if you'll give him short questions, maybe we can get fairly short answers and everybody will have a chance. We'll start with you, Charles.
Major, there's one question I've been wanting to ask you. I have an article from the Charleston Daily Mail about a talk which you apparently gave in Charleston, and I don't know if the gentleman is misquoting you or not, but I'll read it, and I would like to get your comments on this. He said that you said that several projects that would produce artificial gravity permitting such flights, apparently referring to the saucers, now are being conducted. Some leading scientists dealing with the problem have said that it is almost a reality now. Was that pretty accurate?
That is not a verbatim quote. What I said was, and I was talking a little fast, I guess. It was a luncheon club, and you know how you talk, try to get through in a half an hour where everybody wants to run back to his business. I said that in the United States now, there were probably 20, at least a dozen projects research into artificial gravity, and that in one case, the Glenn Martin project, the vice president in charge of advanced design, Mr. G.S. Trimble, said some time ago that we were on the threshold of a device which would operate free of the Earth's gravity, and it would operate at very high speeds, up in the very high thousands. I said, since then, no one has heard from Mr. Trimble, and presumably he was shut up. He will not answer letters. I know I've written him twice to try to get further views on this. And I did not say any exactly what is there, but I can see how he got that impression.
But it is a fact that apparently the Glenn Martin aircraft
Glenn
company
Martin, Convair,
has the impression you have is that they have probably in the testing stages right now an anti-gravity device.
I won't go that far because they won't admit it, but they said that we are on the threshold. I do know they're working hard on artificial gravity, and they won't say a word about it. It's a special project. I think it's even in a special building over there. And several universities are on it. They've gotten some European scientists over here to work on the project.
Just one last question on this, and you may have no information on this at all. In your conversations with these various people, did they give you any indication of the line of attack? Was it an electrical field they were trying to produce, or was it magnetic, or how were they going at it?
Well, you can't get any details on that now, any really reliable ones. The theory was, of course, it was based on Einstein's unified field theory, that electricity, magnetism, and gravity are all different manifestations of the same thing, and if you can control one or two, then you can vary the other. Or you can vary one or two, you can control the other. I tried to get something out of W.B. Smith, the Canadian, who had the Canadian project. He said, I'll be glad to write anything on any subject except that one, and that you won't get any answers from anybody on this because it's under security everywhere.
Jules? referring to the investigator, this isn't a question, but I certainly have been reading it myself, and I certainly agree with John. That's an outstanding publication. What do you think are the prospects for NICAP, Major, and what can be done to improve and enlarge the organization?
Well, that's quite a question, and it's I'm going to give a frank answer. When I went in there a year ago, January, I was told that within a very short time, there would be substantial sums of money coming in to allow us to build it up. We'd have an editor, an editorial assistant, and a promotion man, and public relations, and this, that, and the other, all of which were badly needed. The sum was estimated at around $50,000. On the basis of this, I announced the NICAP magazine and sent letters to all the people who'd read my books, and we sent out quite a number of them, and we had acceptances. And then, after the acceptances, the people who were going to donate the $50,000 in amounts to the magazine, which we put out, and to borrow Winston Churchill, very much sweat and tears. I think it was right. It was just about that and a little bit more, because sometimes it was sheer desperation. But we did get the magazine out, and it was written to be as new and have as much new material as possible. We alternated with bulletins, and we have done our best to keep going, in spite of the fact we had such a small staff down there. I personally have donated my time since last year. I don't know how long I keep on doing that, but NICAP overnight could become a very terrific success if it just had a larger membership. It's all it needs is a larger membership, and a few people, of course, who have been able to have actually sent in donations besides their memberships. But I am a very poor money raiser.
Do you have any idea, Major, pardon me, about how many members it would be necessary to have in order to have a successful organization?
Well, of course, it would be very wonderful if we had 10,000 members, but we can do much. We can do it with much less than that. If we had, in addition, we have now, if we had 2,500 more members, or 3,000 more, our problems would be taken care of, because I would immediately get a hold of an editor. In fact, I put my eyes on my friend John Newberry over here, who used to be on True Magazine, or someone who knows the subject and could really take over, because I've been trying to be director, editor, public relations man, and not doing a good job at any of it.
Well, I wouldn't say that. I think certainly the investigator has been very well put out. And one thing I've noticed that I admired very much, certainly the NICAP has not put itself up as a rival to any organization, as I understand it, but has expressed every desire to cooperate, and even gone so far, as I recall, on one issue, to list practically many, if not all, of the other organizations in existence, not only in this country, but in others, and the publications that are put out. Would you classify NICAP more or less as a mother organization?
No, we were afraid that there would be some jealousy on the part of existing organizations, and at first, I think they felt too that we were trying to take them over. And since then, we've gotten along very well with most of them. Now, some of them don't care too much for our policy. It's middle of the road policy, for instance. But we're not having much trouble, and every once in a while we get information from them, and we'd be glad to cooperate even more with them, as far as that's concerned. And now you mentioned one thing. I'm going to toss this in. On the cooperation, we offered the Air Force cooperation, too. Back in July, we offered them an eight-point plan. And someone said, which one of you gentlemen was, would we consider negative evidence as well as positive evidence? We have said to the Air Force, you claim that you have explained all but 3% of the sightings. If you will let us have the 97% of the cases, since there's no security involved and they're all explained, there's no reason why you shouldn't let us have them. We will turn them over to our advisors and Board of Governors. If we agree you have fully explained them, we will then state the Air Force certainly has done everything they claim. They have explained 97%. We will wipe NICAP out and say, this is it, let's all go home. The Air Force said, we don't want any part of you. They would not release anything. They sent an official letter saying they were rejecting our offer.
I have one last question, Major. On the Armstrong Circle Theater, I recall there was a statistical breakdown as to the number of unexplained and insufficient information. I don't recall a breakdown. I think it was 1.9 or something on unexplained and 12-point insufficient. In your opinion, should the 12-point of insufficient, if that is the number, be classified as insufficient information or unexplained?
Well, I would have to see each case to answer that, but I'll tell you one thing. That 1.9 is very misleading, because that is what they call the current situation. Now, up to November 15th last year, they were advertising that they had explained all the 3%. Then they jumped it suddenly to 1.9. But what they don't let the public realize is that they have a big backlog of unexplained cases that goes back into their special report 14. And there's a table right in the back that shows 19.5% of this group unexplained, which is about 650, and the total today is well over 700, about 750 unexplained cases, or more than 12% of the total.
Carlin Hastings?
When was Project 14 published, Major Kehoe?
It was dated May 5th, 1955, and a friend of mine, pretty high up in the Pentagon, told me at that time, he said, they're going to let that go just in time to knock off your book that's coming out in May. I said, that's very interesting, and Henry Holt will appreciate that, because the book is only about one-third written, and it won't be out for months. And he called me up later, and he said, they've just found out your book's not coming out, and they slapped this secret label on this, and they're going to hold it. So they held it until October, at which time Len Springfield, who put out CRIFO, made a mistake and said in his book that I was coming out in November with the Flying Saucer Conspiracy. And that afternoon at 5 o'clock, Captain Robert White got orders from topside, let it go. So he let it go, and the press men around the Pentagon didn't have any time to get the answers to it. They said, what's it all about? This time of the day. Bang. He said, well, here it is. Explained all but this percent. They ran the story, ran all over the United States. And then my book didn't come out till December. By that time, things had sort of cooled up. Also, Ruppel's book was coming out, so they figured they'd knock us both off at the same time. And that is the most misleading document, I think, that's ever been put out. Now, I don't say they're lying to the people, but it's either the most complete blunder of misstatements that has ever been published that I've ever seen, or else it's a deliberate deception.
It's interesting to hear your description. You don't say it's completely lying, but it certainly is far from the truth. So I think the listening audience will probably make up its mind as to just what it is. Major Kehoe, why doesn't the Air Force want NICAP?
Well, they know very well that our intention is to get everything out in the open and to try to get the answers made available to the press. In fact, one suggestion we had was that they hold a huge press conference and bring out everything, and we will be over there giving our side and asking questions too. Let's get it out in the open, and that's one thing they will never agree to, because there are too many questions that they couldn't answer. And that's also why we want this Senate investigation.
Couldn't answer, or they don't want to answer?
Oh, they could answer most of them, but I do think there's some things that they don't understand even yet about these. I'm not even sure they know the motives, but I'm sure they know that these things operate in cycles, and they probably know the method of propulsion. I think they do have a good idea of the type of beings involved, although I'm not sure of that. And they know very well that they're real and that they're from some other part of the universe.
Would you repeat that again a moment?
They know they're real.
Now, who knows?
The Air Force knows.
The Air Force knows what?
That these objects are real, and they're objects under intelligent control of beings from some other part of the universe, either our solar system or outside.
Albert Chopp stated that, didn't he, in 1953, when he was after he was head of the information Pentagon?
He didn't say it that way. What he said was that there was a secret report which had been held up, and I found out which one it was later on. That was the Foreign Aid report, and then but the 1948 report was the big one. That was the one where ATIC declared these things were interplanetary spaceships. And even though all Air Force doesn't accept it, that was the top brains at that time in intelligence.
What do you feel is this is the last question, Major Kehoe? What do you feel is the best way of the American public counteracting this suppression of news by the Air Force? In fact, this out-and-out censorship against which we fought World Wars I and II.
Well, I still think that the only way you can help now is to write to your congressman, write to your senators and ask that they pass the word on to the Senate committee and have open hearings. And not just call the Air Force and NICAP and a few scientists and so forth, but call at least 100 selected witnesses, the best airline captains, I mean the ones with the most experience who've seen these, top-ranking officers in the armed forces, the civil aeronautics tower operators and radar operators who've seen these things, the guided missile trackers, the people who photographed them. Get them in there. It may take a month. But believe me, when they get through with a thing like that, it'll be out in the open and they can't ever close it up again.
To whom should they write in Congress? You say that Senate Investigation Committee.
Each citizen write to his own congressman and senators. And that's it.
Thank you very, very much, Major Keyhole. I certainly appreciate it, and I know our listeners do, to have the opportunity of hearing your opinions on this subject, and I sincerely hope that when and if you do come back to New York, and if you can spare the time, that you will join us again.
Well, thank you very much. It's been a great pleasure, and I appreciate your cooperation.
Thank you, sir. I'll be back with you in just about 4 or 5 minutes. I'd like to take the opportunity of saying goodnight to Major Keyhole, and then we'll...
Sorry, I'm going to have to interrupt.
We've talked this morning with Major Donald E. Keyhole of NICAP. We've had Cortland Hastings with us, Charles Leedham, Ben Iskowitz. Our engineers, Russell Tinklepaw, and Al Nielsen. Phil Thompson will be along in just a few minutes. I sincerely hope you have a very, very pleasant weekend. And if you're getting up, have a nice Sunday. Don't forget to go to church. And if you're going to bed, get a good night's sleep. It's real good. Bless you.